down.
That's right.
Jason, you know, I assume he'd be here, but and then Rolf. Rolf was, I don't know if you know him, Rolf Aper. U of A PD. He retired there and works in the city now.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
But he got on our board a few years ago.
Nice.
Hey, Dennis, for the minutes, can I get the information on your guest?
Hi there.
Oh, hi. Brian. Yeah.
My name is Brian with a Y, B-R-Y-A-N, Jeffries, J-E-F-F-R-I-E-S, and I work for Public Safety Financial.
Public Safety Financial. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And just so you guys know, I have started recording because I have a terrible tendency to not start recording if I don't do it early.
Okay.
Thanks.
Is he going to be here, you know?
Cassie's invited, right?
Oh, I'm sure she is.
Yeah. She didn't say she wasn't there. Oh. Excuse me.
Yes, she was invited, and I did also send her the board packet when that went out last week.
Okay. Morning,
Lisa, did we get the documents? I might have missed that email.
Yes, Don sent them out.
Okay, let me look it up.
I think Monday or Friday?
Friday or Monday.
Yeah. Okay, I got it. Thanks.
I'm
in Dallas in case I lose connectivity.
I'm busy.
I'm
doing debt issuance right now, so.
Oh, I remember that noise.
Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of stuff on my
phone. I don't understand. When I left here, it's been a decade now. You know, you had one person doing treasury, one doing benefits, one doing, and I could see, you know, they pretty much chased Art out of here.
Well,
as many hats as you were.
Yeah. The problem is that I'm teaching everybody below me. They weren't taught how to do all that stuff. So
what are you doing?
You never know where my head's going to pop up, Cassie. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
What a pleasant surprise. How nice to see you today.
You too. Hi, everybody.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah. I'm just as excited to see all of you too. Just didn't expect Brian.
Good morning, Cassie.
I started work on a project for her 3 years ago. I'm still waiting for a return phone call. And it really got me because it's something that's important. And I was going to rewrite all the AD. They had me starting out with the other equipment, fixed asset AD, because the last time we reviewed the letter with it had my name on it.
Oh, gosh.
Back then, Scott Douthat was here, remember?
Yes. But,
and they're like, hey, we want you to rewrite it. So I got it done. And then, but it was while in the middle of work, so it wasn't going anywhere.
Wow.
And I just kind of laughed. And, well, because the AEDs, I found them out there for the public to read. I'm like, you kidding me? There's AEDs from the 80s, because it's on the
on the
clerk's website through there. And I'm like, oh man, come on. Anyway.
So crazy.
Yeah, you're a word.
Sure. Okay.
The citizen. Okay, I got 9 o'clock. Good morning, everybody. It is 9 o'clock, Thursday, May 14th, 2026. This is the quarterly meeting of the City of Tucson's Deferred Compensation Plan Management Board. We'll take roll. Angel.
Here.
You're here. Okay. Yes. Joby?
Here.
Dennis? Here. Terry?
Here.
Lisa?
Here.
Rolf?
Here.
And Jason?
Here.
We have a quorum, 7. Okay, consent agenda. I'll assume everyone's had a chance to read the minutes from the last board meeting. If there's any discussion, open for it. Otherwise, I'll take a motion to approve the minutes.
Joby, I'll make a motion to approve the minutes from the February 12th meeting.
I get a second.
Second.
Lisa seconds it. Okay, we'll take roll call. Angel?
Hi.
Joby?
Yes.
Dennis? Aye. Terry?
Aye.
Lisa?
Aye.
Rolf?
Aye.
And Jason?
Aye.
Okay, passes 7-0. Okay, Innovest, item C, Innovest quarterly report. First item is ownership change. I'd like to defer to Cassie on this. When it was first brought to us back in February, it appears to me that this is an SEC requirement. I personally don't know whether, if we don't consent, what does that mean? Is there something there, or is it consent and that's all there is to it?
Well, in my view, I mean, yes, I do think that it's required that we receive the notice of the ownership change. And if you consent, you still have the ability under your contract to make changes in the future. So I don't see harm in the consent itself. And if the board wants to have any more information or has any specific questions about the ownership change, then that's a discussion item that's appropriate. But the consent will allow the current relationship to continue.
Okay, thank you. Anyone have any commentary on that? Because if not, I'll open it up for a motion.
Mr. Chair, do you want to hear from Innovest to see if they want to put anything in the record beyond what you discussed in February.
Thank you for that idea. Gordon, Troy, Rick?
Sure. I'd be happy to comment. I think Kathy did a great job of capturing exactly what the essence of this is. It's to ensure that we're providing informing our clients of the new addition to the ownership. And the consent is really just acknowledging that we made you aware of that and you'd like to continue with our current agreement. It doesn't extend our agreement. It doesn't change the scope of the agreement or anything else. It really is just consent of the acknowledgement. Kathy, thanks for capturing everything.
Thanks, Rick.
Yeah, and I just would note it's business as usual for us. Purpose of this transaction was really to help us become a little less top heavy. You know, the founders of the organization own a good portion of it. They're not retiring, but in thinking about succession over a period of time, we were looking for an investor, and this was the minimal impact. You know, many of our peers out there have become owned by private equity. They've gone back to Wall Street. This ultimately is an investor that just wanted to be part of our growth over a period of time. He's an entrepreneur and owns several parts of several successful companies, and that's really the position here. So, and to be frank, actually, I've never had the opportunity to meet him. So impact is pretty minimal on what we do and how we will continue to serve our clients.
And Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes.
I believe the notice, Gordon and Rick, said that the investor has the option to increase their ownership beyond the 40%. Do they have the option to take that to a majority share?
They do.
Okay.
If certain conditions are met.
Okay. And that would be, is that gradual under the arrangement, or could that happen suddenly?
No, it is, and over time, and I believe the soonest under the arrangement is 3 years.
Okay. The 3 years before they could go beyond their current stake?
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Because I do think that your contract with the board is up for renewal, right, in this coming June, next month, right? Already?
Yes.
So I think that it does tie in. Obviously, the consent is a separate item, but the board should consider, you know, when a motion on the renewal is appropriate, whether it's time for an RFP, those issues also.
I'm thinking that's something we would take up maybe in our as a future agenda item. Today, we're pretty much just concerned with providing the consent. And then amongst the board, we can discuss what our next steps are. But we're definitely going for at least another year with Innovest, because we're not going to quit next month.
Okay. And so, then, I'm just looking at the agenda, and I think you're correct, Mr. Chair, that the renewal is not on the agenda. So we'll have to put that on the next meeting so that can be ratified as of June of 26.
And this is Joby. Dennis, yeah. Just for my commentary, obviously, I think the way that it was originally delivered, we had some issues with it because it was just sent to one person. We talked about this last meeting. I think Innovest explained it well, and it was an SEC requirement. So at this point, knowing that our contract is, I think it continues every 30 days anyways, is how the contract's written. I don't have a problem providing the consent of the ownership change. And then we'll just go into future meetings to figure out what we need to do, whether that's a continuation or RFP. So.
Thank you. Anyone else? So, Cassie, do we actually have to make a motion for this consent?
I think mm-hmm. that that's appropriate to have a motion to acknowledge okay. that the ownership change was disclosed and the board is accepting the notice.
Okay. I will entertain a motion.
So move.
Who's that? Angel?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We get a second?
I'll second, Rolf.
Rolf, okay. Okay, we'll take a roll call on that. Angel?
Aye.
Joby?
Aye.
Dennis? Aye. Terry?
Aye.
Lisa?
Aye.
Rolf?
Aye.
And Jason?
Aye.
Okay, passes 7-0. And we'll put that on the agenda for our August meeting to discuss how we go forward. Unless we elect to have a meeting between now and that August meeting. Okay, item C2, the first quarter 2026 portfolio review. Innovest.
Okay, I'll share my screen. Thank you. Can everyone see the screen?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you for confirming. Our performance report starts with an update on the firm, and I'm pleased to report that we continue to grow and do well. We had our best year ever last year. We've brought in several new clients, and as a result, we have done quite a bit of hiring. And already in the early part of this year, we continue to support the community. That's a big component of who we are. I probably should have mentioned earlier when we were talking about the transaction that one of the important components in bringing in an investor is that we could maintain our culture of stewardship. And that is not just stewardship to the clients, although that comes first, but stewardship to our employees and our community as well. And so we feel like the family office investor that is a new partial owner at Innovest will allow us to continue that without any change to the culture of Innovest. That's followed by the history for the city of Tucson with Innovest. And this is by no means meant to replace the meeting minutes, but just a documentation of material changes and decisions that have been made by the committee, divided up by each one of the years. And we'll continue adding to this as time passes. And then the next section of the report is a rotating section that we title Fiduciary Topics and Trends. And we rotate quarter to quarter on everything from legislative and regulatory updates to industry trends, fiduciary education, and other topics that we think are timely and useful to share with our retirement plan committee members. And this one starts with some updates to the savings limits that were announced at the end of the year in 2025. The standard maximum moved from 23.5 to 24.5, so a $1,000 increase. The catch-up provision remains at 8,000 total. So anyone age 50 or over could contribute up to 32.5 between those two. And then something new for this year is this special catch-up. And really in the deferred compensation world, the 457 space, separating that from the 401k corporate space, we've had something going back to the inception of the code that created 457 plans. And that goes back to 1978. We've had something already called the special catch-up. So for deferred compensation plans, we're referring to this new one as the super catch-up. And it's applicable only to employees that are between ages 60 and 63. And for that four-year period, they can contribute an amount that's greater than the age 50 catch-up. And so for 2026, that amount is $11,250. And combined with the standard limit, they could contribute a total of $35,750. Under compliance and plan operations changes, you may recall that the SECURE Act and SECURE 2.0 address changes to required minimum distributions, or RMDs. And so with the pre-tax money that's held in the 457 plans, once you retire, you'll get to an age where even if you didn't want to take distributions, the IRS will force you to take distributions, referred to as RMDs. That used to be age 70 and a half. Technically, because it's IRS code, it was a little more complicated than that. It was April of the year following the year you turned 70 and a half, but let's just go with 70 and a half. And that was moved to 73. And that'll increase in the early 2030s, but it will be 73 for some time to come. If you are starting a brand new plan today, a 401k or a 403b plan with a company or nonprofit organization, new legislation that came out of Secure 2.0 requires for those plans to include automatic enrollment. And the only reason we highlight this is that we can see, as we look ahead to what will future legislative proposals look like, we think there's going to be more and more automation. After the Pension Protection Act of 2006, you know, what came out of that was the ability to include automatic enrollment, not a mandate, but an option, the ability to include automatic contribution increases, the ability to have a qualified default investment alternative. So we just see more and more automation coming down the road. Also new for 2026 is a mandatory Roth catch-up requirement for participants that earned greater than $150,000 in FICA wages last year. And so anyone eligible for the age 50 plus or the age 60 to 63 super catch-up, meeting that earning limit, would be subject to being mandatory Roth catch-up contributions. Could not do it in a pre-tax fashion. On the policy landscape, I don't know about all of you as committee members. I can tell you on the provider side of the industry, there was a lot that was contained in Secure Act and Secure 2.0. So we would love to have some time to settle and get all of those resolved before there's any additional legislation. But believe it or not, certain members of Congress are already discussing Secure 3.0. There's nothing formal that's been disclosed about what might be included in that. If you were to ask me to guess, I would say probably further Rothification. Congress likes that. If they could push those saving money in retirement plans, whether it be a governmental 457 plan or 401k or 403b, if they could push more of that to Roth rather than pre-tax, it creates additional tax revenue today and it kicks down the road the eventual tax benefits to the participants. There was a Department of Labor had issued a fiduciary rule in 2024 that essentially forced investment advisors giving advice on a retirement plan to do so in a fiduciary fashion. And the brokerage industry and the insurance industry had their lobbyists really fight hard to shoot this down, and they were successful. So at this point, we're moving back to this five-part test to figure out who is a fiduciary when giving advice to a retirement plan or a participant in a retirement plan. And the most contested of those five parts was one that requires the advisor to give continual advice. So because Innovest, for example, is providing continual advice to this committee, and it's your primary source of advice and some of the other reasons too, that makes us a fiduciary advisor. That's one of the reasons that makes us a fiduciary advisor. But imagine if you had a local insurance agent that was approaching your participants and encouraging them to roll money out of the plan and into an IRA where they purchase an annuity. And then after the annuity is sold, there is no more advice. And so that annuity salesperson would be exempt from being a fiduciary. These rules, this five-part test wouldn't apply to them because that's not ongoing and continuous advice. It was a one-time event. And what does this mean for us as plan fiduciaries, Innovest, and our clients? It means that we really ought to encourage the record keeping providers to promote the benefits of remaining in the plan. We don't want to force them to remain in the plan, but we want to make sure that they're well educated, that they understand participating in the plan, they're under this umbrella of fiduciary oversight and protection, that they're accessing institutional pricing to investments, that they have access to a robust array of services ranging from investment advice to investment guidance and financial planning, and that rolling their money over to an advisor outside the plan will likely lead to increased costs and ultimately a reduction in benefits. So that's why we share this information with you. Finally, the next and last section of the fiduciary topics and trends this quarter is a look at the change in what was called the Savers Credit. And for low-income individuals, historically, if they made a contribution to a retirement plan, and that could be a retirement plan at work, like the 457 plan, it could be an IRA, but separate from that, they would get a tax credit when they filed their income taxes. And legislators realized, well, that's a great idea, but that tax credit likely is not making it into their retirement account. So it's being replaced with something called the Savers Match. And it doesn't start until next year. Again, it's targeting lower income individuals. But on the first $2,000 that one contributes who is eligible, the federal government will match 50% of that, so up to $1,000. What's unclear as we sit here today is how that will happen. We don't know, we haven't received guidance as to how will the federal government make that contribution. Will they send it to the record keeper? Will they send it to you, the plan sponsor? Will they require the individual to open up an IRA, and will they deposit into the IRA? So we're awaiting guidance on how that will be handled practically, but we wanted to make you aware of the change that's coming next year and assure you that we'll continue to provide updates. And then lastly, the Home Savings Act, which hasn't been passed, it's just proposed, as you see there, really takes the concept of borrowing money from your retirement account for purchase of real estate to kind of another level. So it would allow for a penalty-free withdrawal, not just a loan, for down payments or closing costs. And then the second bullet point is unique to anything we've seen in the past. It would allow you not only to take out money for purchase of real estate for yourself, but purchase of real estate for a gift to a relative. Again, we don't have details on this proposal, but we'll continue to monitor and report back. And before I move on, any questions about the items that I covered in topics and trends?
Yes, good morning. I have, Mr. Chair, I have some questions. Let me go back to that page. Okay, so for the going to page five, what I heard is that for earners older than 64, the catch-up does not apply. Am I correct?
Correct. The super catch-up does not, but you would go back to the age 50-plus catch-up. So for that four-year period from 60 to 63, mm-hmm. you know, at present, the catch-up amount would be $11,250. And mm-hmm. then at 64, it reverts back to
$8,000. Okay. And then the second block, the last item, is it the third item, requires earners making more than 150, the catch-up needs to be on a Roth basis. Does that also include the 50 plus?
It does. It's anything that's catch-up. And I didn't cover this because there wasn't a bullet point on this slide here, but I alluded to it and mentioned that we've had something since the inception of deferred compensation plans called a special catch-up provision, and that allows eligible participants to do double the standard maximum. So in this case, it would be double the 24.5 or in other words, 49,000. And if someone was doing that special catch-up provision, that would also be, that's the only one that would not be subject to this Roth catch-up requirement.
Could you repeat that, please? I'm not sure I captured that.
Yeah. So for 457 plans, they now have three different catch-up provisions. There's the age 50 plus. There's what I call the super catch-up, which is the 60 to 63. And there's something that's been around for a long time called the special catch-up provision. And this is the only one that requires you to prove that you're eligible to catch up for something that you didn't contribute to. So in other words, you'd go back and you'd calculate. For example, in a year you were eligible to contribute 20,000 and you only contributed 15. Well, you've got $5,000 that year that you can make up for. And then there's a three-year period prior to your normal retirement age where you can contribute double whatever the standard maximum is. So this year, that would be 49,000, 24, 5 times 2. That special catch-up provision was not called out in this Roth catch-up requirement. So that's the only one that's exempt from it.
So that special catch-up, that double the 24.5, would be on a Roth basis also, would it?
It would not be. That's the only one that would not be.
So it would be tax deferred?
Correct.
Okay. Good to know.
Well, and Rick, that would be, the employee would have a choice.
That's a great point. So it'd be optional. It wouldn't be mandatory.
So how do we get this information out to our employees outside of this board meeting?
There's been a fairly robust initiative with Empower and other record keepers across the country to communicate this. And this communication started a couple of years ago, and maybe even before that, because this was initially scheduled to take place in 2024, and providers, including record keepers and payroll providers, were just not set up to handle it. So it was pushed for 2 years.
So that additional catch-up of double the elective deferral, where would that be deposited? You said it's not Roth, so is there a special account for that? Or is it in the same 457?
It's in the same 457, but the participant would have the option of choosing if they wanted to make it pre-tax or Roth.
Got you.
It wouldn't be mandated to be Roth like the other two.
Okay.
If I may, we have been discussing with Keenan at Empower about doing some teams, possibly some teams tutorials for employees to learn more about the catch-up. So we're working on that currently to get that information out to employees.
That's great.
Well, just so everybody knows.
Well,
yeah, I agree with Angel. I think that some of these things like that don't get pushed out, or I missed it too, which I don't know if I would miss it. But yeah, that type of information is very valuable so that the plan participants can maximize their contributions. Like me being a little older, I'm trying to max everything out. And I wasn't aware of that last one. I basically have my whole check going to it, so.
Oh, Keenan's on the call. There he is.
Good, Keenan. You're muted. Okay.
Oh, there it is. There it is. Can you hear me? So I actually teach that at the NEWs now that I speak at every other week. That's on our contribution screen, but it's also something that, especially if a participant has been asking, I determine what their age is and which category that they fit into for their contribution amount. But it does seem to be one of the most important things that participants find of value in the meetings. So that's one reason we try to encourage as many people to be showing up to do their in-person account reviews during the year, just so that, you know, because it's usually a case by case. Obviously, it's an age thing, but all the more reason to do a webinar, which we've got some webinar material on that I can always run through that Lisa, I think, was referring to. So that's kind of where we've been.
And Keenan, could you put your email in the chat for us?
What?
I have another thing.
Oh,
sorry. And just one more thing. One of our goals for FY27 for the pension team is education. There's just not enough, I feel, after being in my role for the last, I think it's been 8 months now, that there's just not enough education out there for employees. So we're going to start updating our website to be more robust with information, a handbook. I also have some staff that are going to be doing more life stages education. So working with more younger employees and, you know, older employees. What to do when you're 5 years from retirement, what to do when you're 10 years, 20 years. So we need a lot of education in that sense. So a lot of people don't know about deferred comp, what to do with it, how they can use it. So we're just starting out, but that's our goal for FY27. So just putting it out there for everybody. But that's my main goal right now.
That's a good goal. And this is Gordon. I might comment just that we do have many clients actually integrate the education. So if there's an opportunity, as you provide education on the pension plan, to bring in Empower and promote the deferred compensation plan as a partner in those types of education sessions.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Rolf. If there's anything I can do to help push that, I'd be happy to do it. Because absolutely. I think sometimes things come out, but I think if there's a personal touch and like reaching out, I think
outreach too. We plan on doing outreach, going out there to departments, being out there more, maybe even with benefits, trying to do some kind of joint thing with benefits, things like that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Back to you, Rick.
I'm sorry, Dennis.
Sorry.
Rolf, I want to add, you know, while there's been some communication, the Empower record keeping system is smart enough when participants are changing deferrals to recognize that somebody's over 50, right? So it'll show the increased limit. Same when they're over 60. And then additionally, we have to identify who those 150,000 or over earners are. And just for clarification, it's in FICA wages, because we know that not everybody, pays into FICA. But if we have an indicator for those individuals, then we're on the deferral record keeping system making notification that, hey, if you reach your limit of 24,500 this year and you're going to continue to contribute, the city will change your contributions to Roth. And that was part of the rules, is that you could have a deemed Roth election and change. So there is some additional information out there for folks when they're using our slider to change their deferrals, so that they're aware of what's happening.
Thank you.
Great. Well, if there are no additional questions, I'll keep moving forward. The next item in the report is what we call the blueprint. And it's a high-level overview of plan provisions, contributions, governance, costs, and then on the right side, the important repeatable deliverables and processes that we conduct on behalf of our due diligence process for the plan. That's followed by the annual fee review. As the name suggests, this is updated annually. And the next time we meet, I believe we will see an updated version of this one. But I would just point out that we include it in each one of the quarterly reports so that it's clear that the committee and your consultant are continually monitoring fees and expenses, and that we're aware of how your plan benchmarks to a broad set of other plans of similar size. And the benchmarking is in the very top section here in the blue row, where you can see that all in weighted average investment expense, so those are the fees paid to the mutual fund providers, and the administration and record keeping costs, the fees paid to Empower, come in at 32 basis points, or about a third of 1%. That benchmarks favorably to the median of other similarly sized plans that are at about half a percent, or 49 basis points. And again, in the next quarterly reporting, we'll provide the latest update of the fee and expense analysis. That's followed by an overview of the investment menu for both of the plans. And we break the investment menu into tiers. And I think these tiers are best described generally by the level of sophistication and engagement on behalf of the participants. So tier one is designed for the participants that choose to be the least engaged, turn over the investment selection, asset allocation, diversification, and ongoing management process to investment professionals. In this case, the professionals at Capital Group, which manages American funds, target date funds, suite. And then tier two, our obligation here as fiduciaries is to provide a broad array of investments in various asset classes and sub-asset classes that give your employees who seek to build and manage their own portfolios the ability to create portfolios that range from conservative to aggressive and everything in between. And then tier three is designed for the more engaged participants in their desire to invest through the brokerage window or use a managed account where they would be adding outside assets, spousal or partner assets, and do more robust planning and investing. And so the menu looks great across the board. And then finally, that's followed by the asset allocation page. And here we look at the balance of each one of the funds in dollars and also as a percentage of total plan assets. Then it's subtotaled by sub-asset class. And we're looking at balances as of the end of the most recent and the prior quarter. We're really looking here, especially when there's periods of volatility, to identify any trends that might be concerning. For example, during a volatile period, do we see participants panicking and selling out of equities, moving into fixed income, moving into the stable value fund, or something of that nature? And I'm pleased to report that we make no such observation. We also track utilization in the target date funds. It's at about 17.5%. Interestingly, exactly unchanged, which rarely happens from the previous quarter. And we make similar observations on the 401A, with the exception that we see greater utilization in the target date funds. So nothing concerning to report. And before I move on, any question about the governance section of the report thus far, other than what we've already discussed? Okay. The next section in the report moves us to capital markets and takes a look at recent performance of major market indexes to begin with. If you don't like the Seattle Seahawks, I apologize for the color scheme here. I don't know why we use this color scheme, but we have for some time. So it wasn't to support a team, trust me. But what we see in the blue bars is the most recent performance in the first quarter of this year. And the green bars are trailing 12 months. So in this case, it'd be April 1st of last year through March 31st of this year. And you can see it was a really, really rough quarter. Really, things started to go south in late February when the war with Iran started. I'm pleased to report, though, that since the end of the quarter, things have really turned around. April was great. The first half of May has been great too. And the numbers that you see in orange show where we are year to date through yesterday. So the S&P 500, which is large cap stocks, are up almost 9% for the year now, whereas at the end of March, we were down just over 4%. Small cap stocks were up only about 1% through March. Now they're up 14.5%. Developed foreign stocks are up 8%, and emerging markets are up over 20 now, up 22% through yesterday. Really, bonds, which is core fixed income, largely unchanged. In fact, when I looked at numbers for the market through yesterday, it was at the exact same number, minus 0.05. So we are seeing a nice rebound since the end of the first quarter. I think that, you know, if you're curious as to why is this happening, particularly with emerging markets, and even developed markets as well, foreign stocks, I think there's been a realization that the impact of tariffs wasn't as severe as they initially thought it might be on these economies. There's also a consideration of the dollar being weak, given that we continue to add more and more debt. There are some concerns around some of the current administration's policies that might create struggles and potentially more inflation, although we're not seeing it right now. Having said that, the domestic markets are doing well also. Again, up 9% on large caps and over 14% on small cap stocks. So if we look at the economy overall, I won't go through every one of the bullet points on this slide. I know it's a lot. I'll just give a high-level overview. But if we start in the upper left with the economy, thinking about GDP, a measure of our total economic output, we've had a lot of sort of back and forth here. In the third quarter of last year, GDP was up 4.5%, 4.4, which is a really strong number. Then fourth quarter, GDP dropped to increasing only by 0.5%. And if you recall, that was in the heart of the government shutdown. And while consumer spending remained relatively strong in the fourth quarter, government spending pretty much disappeared. So that was a big impact on that. And if you just looked at the GDP number alone, not a great reflection on the current status of the economy at that time. First estimate just came in, and it came in at 2%, which is pretty consistent with long-term average. If you go back over, say, the last 25, 26 years, long-term average is about 2.2. So we're about average first quarter. And there was still, partial government shutdown in that first quarter period. Looking at the labor markets, largely unchanged. We're at about 4.3% unemployment. We continue to add roughly about the same number of jobs. And we're pretty close to full employment. When you're over 95% employment, that's considered very close to full employment. Inflation hasn't changed much either. Still just over 3%, which is higher than the Fed's target of around 2%. And given that there are not much changes there, there is the war with Iran. We think that there's less probability that we'll see any more interest rate cuts, at least in the short term. We entered this year, the consensus among economists was that we might see 2, 3, maybe even 4 interest rate cuts, but some things have changed since then. And in the first meetings, we've seen nothing. We think that the biggest risks that we see for investors going forward, obviously geopolitical, and then what will happen with the Fed. There's a change in the Fed chairman upcoming. So the new Fed chairman incoming, at least that's proposed, probably more dovish than Chairman Powell. So we'll see where that goes, but the signals are probably unchanged in the short term. Now, as we share this information with you, it's not expected to drive any changes in the investment menu. You're not expected to recommend that participants make changes to their portfolios using this information, but it's really just to help the committee members understand recent changes in the markets and some of the attribution for the same. But let me pause and see if there are any questions so far. Okay. I'll keep moving. I won't go deep into these slides, but I'll just share with you some of the interesting items that we put in the report. Obviously, one of the big concerns is what happens to markets during geopolitical events. The short takeaway here is that during the event, historically, there's been a lot of volatility, and we have 14 different geopolitical events going back to the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 60s. What we would point out is that the average return 3 years after the geopolitical event was 12%. And the message to participants concerned about this, if asked, is that history suggests that you're best off continuing to take a long-term approach, especially with your retirement savings. A lot of questions about oil. We became energy independent in 2019, and this chart just shows that the significance of Europe and China and their dependency on imported oil compared to the U.S. That said, it still, I think, prompts the question, why am I paying $5 a gallon for gas if we're energy independent and it's gone down so much? And the answer is, at least in part, that we're selling some of this to others. And oil, like all commodities, is a supply and demand market. And so it's driven prices up. Last I looked, and that was earlier this week, West Texas crude was at about $107 a barrel. So with those elevated prices, I think we'll continue to see high prices at the gas pump. And then lastly, I just wanted to point out that, and you saw this in the first chart, that we continue to experience outperformance of foreign stocks with domestic stocks. One thing I point out here, and maybe I did this last quarter, I apologize if this is redundant. It is worth mentioning, though, is that one of the things that we love about the target date funds, the managed accounts, and anyone working with an advisor is they're more prone to having a larger allocation to foreign stocks in their portfolios. We find that generally do-it-yourself investors have historically underweighted that. There's kind of a home bias. I invest in what I know, and that's domestic stocks. And they've missed out on some really robust performance that we've observed lately. So I'll wrap the capital markets piece there. I'm going to turn it over to Gordon to talk about sub-asset class performance and then the investments in your plan. Before I do you have any questions for us regarding the economy or capital markets? Okay. I hope the lack of questions doesn't mean it was uninteresting or that I was on mute the whole time. But I appreciate your time. Gordon, would you like me to drive for you or would you like me to swap?
Yeah, I'll only cover a few pages here, so you can continue to drive on this one, and then I can take over on the other one. And yeah, I'll be real quick on this particular page. You know, probably most notable is the red on this particular page. You know, this is a heat map, but looking at the equity markets, you know, certainly a lot of dark green, which is very good, really through the 1, 3, 5, and 10-year timeframes. Some really strong performance through all the equity markets, but we did see a definite rotation in this first quarter of 2026. You know, for a long time, we've talked about the big outperformance of what's coined as the Magnificent Seven or the big mega rapidly growing companies here in the U.S., you know, the Amazons, the Microsofts, the Metas, the Alphabets, companies like that have really driven the market for an extended period of time. And that's really reflected in that top right-hand corner. You look at the past year, large value stocks, those more traditional stable parts of the market, still a very good number, up 12.9%, but those large growth stocks up 22.7% over that 1 year time frame. Big rotation in this first quarter. Really what we saw was a sell off of the the very AI-oriented large growth companies, concerns over the spending on AI and the actual implementation and ability for those AI capabilities to create revenue, also impacted software companies, concerns to some extent that AI may impact the ability for software companies to be profitable on a go-forward basis. So big change there, those small value companies, the best place to be in what was, a pretty modest quarter across the board. Interestingly enough, since this first quarter ended, we've seen the markets flip again, and that really is sort of a hallmark of the markets at this point in time. So we've seen those large mega caps ultimately come roaring back pretty dramatically, and for the quarter that we're in, this would almost look in reverse. Markets are very, very positive, but large value sort of back in trailing those large growth stocks. With that, why don't we go right to the manager scorecard on page 21. We think an important page here. Really, this is Innovest's thinking around each of the investments within the plan. The analysts within Innovest that track each of these funds score them on a green, yellow, and red basis across all those criteria across the top. So many of those qualitative statistics are forward-looking. You know, do we believe these funds can perform well on a go-forward basis? And that includes, you know, the strength and the focus of the organization, the culture of that organization, DEI efforts and philanthropy efforts, things like that. The people who is actually managing your money, their experience, their tenure, their education, the process and philosophy they use to actually buy the securities that go into the fund, and if they apply that process and philosophy consistently. So really all qualitative factors there. As we move to the right, a little more quantitative and less sort of forward-looking, but looking back historically. So asset base, funds can get both too small and too big. If they get too small, they're not producing the revenue they have in the past, and we might see strain on resources given to the fund. If they get too big, sometimes sort of like a large ship, difficult to navigate. Performance, we look at 3 and 5 year timeframes as well as their consistency over time. Expenses, really looking at comparable funds and just would like to see those funds be under median as we compare them to other funds. And then overall, a subjective assessment by that analyst inside Innovest that follows each particular fund and an assessment of sort of all of that criteria wrapped up into a single score. So scorecard looks pretty good, we would say. A couple changes on one fund over this particular quarter, but to sort of touch briefly on each. Top to bottom, the T. Rowe Price Growth Stock Fund. This is the fund that's tasked with investing in those large growth stocks and a minor concern for performance. They've stumbled a little bit as we really just think about those seven stocks being the big driver of performance. A little misallocation among those seven big stocks can cause some problems. And that's what we've seen here. Still pretty good faith in T. Rowe Price capabilities in managing growth funds. That really is a focus of that particular firm. So qualitative characteristics, positive, and we'll just continue to watch this one for a bit. The J.P. Morgan Midcap Growth Fund has seen a little bit of change within their portfolio management team. Not departures from the organization, but just a shifting among their growth funds. We really do think a lot of their growth team, and so a pretty minor concern in that particular case. The two blue boxes represent a change over the course of this particular quarter. So moving from this fourth quarter into this quarter, that creates or represents two new minor concerns, and that is for the Victory Sycamore Small Company Opportunities Fund. This is a fund that's tasked with buying those small value-oriented or more traditional stable-type companies within that market. So both an asset-based concern, we've seen assets flow out of this particular fund, and then a performance concern, meaning that they're not keeping up with the market over that 3 and 5 year timeframe. In many cases, that performance concern being created will create that asset-based concern. Retail investors will get out of funds as they start to see performance concerns. But again, on a go-forward basis, those qualitative factors still solid in this particular case. So just a recommendation to continue to watch this particular fund. And then the only other remaining fund on the scorecard is that Invesco Developing Markets Fund that's tasked with going out to those emerging economies and investing in the companies globally in those emerging economies, places like China and India, a few changes with this fund. So they had a longtime manager depart the fund, and four individuals come in to take over management of that particular fund. They've seen a pretty dramatic outflow of assets on that fund, and they also have a performance concern. With all of those concerns, we do have a search for you today. So that'll be my next piece of business, is to look for a candidate to bring into this particular spot on the menu. So we are considering replacing that particular fund, and that would actually eliminate all those scoring concerns on that particular line. I think with that, I'll touch briefly on the table of returns. And I think most notable here is what I noted on that sort of category or heat map, is just the big difference between the value stocks and the growth stocks. If you take a look at this past quarter, you know, your JP Morgan Equity Income Fund, that's the large value fund, in a nice position. They were up actually 1.64%. That 41 in parentheses means that they ranked in the 41st percentile. They beat essentially 59% of those other large value managers out there during the course of the quarter. Ultimately, held back a little bit by exposure to financial stocks. Financial companies have been a little bit soft over the more recent timeframes, again, more around AI concerns than anything else. Then that T. Rowe Price growth stock fund that I talked about, third set down. In green, that's the fund performance, down 11.21% in the 82nd percentile. So definitely not where we like to see it. And those 3 and 5 year numbers is really what creates that performance concern. This is a fund that is a big believer in those AI hyperscalers. So they hold a lot in those mega size type stocks. And in a quarter in which those stocks turned down pretty dramatically, this definitely hurt this particular fund. Interesting enough, if we look at that performance in the current quarter, this fund is up 16.5% so far just in the second quarter. So pretty dramatic turnaround, and sort of reflects the crazy market we're in right now, because things can change so dramatically on just the turn of a dime, and certainly the turn of just some headlines out there. As we drop down, Victory Sycamore Established Value, also the same manager of that Victory Sycamore Small Company Fund that I talked about, a very tenured individual running this particular fund. Nice quarter, up 4.71% and in the 22nd percentile. Again, underweight those financial stocks that I talked about that hurt JP Morgan a little bit, helped in this particular case. And again, good consistency for this fund over the long run. Also a little bit of a crazy category is that JP Morgan Mid-Cap Growth Fund. Two stocks in particular in this particular category grew to be actually 10% each of this particular index, a company called Palantir and a company called AppLovin. Hard for many companies to hold that much in a single stock, especially in a really well-diversified, broad type index like the Mid-Cap Growth Index. JP Morgan definitely held some of them, but not sort of that index level. So they were a little bit behind the index, a little bit ahead of the index, a little bit behind their peers over the course of the quarter. But long-term performance above that median, which is really sort of our basic threshold. And then again, notable Victory Sycamore Small Company Opportunities Fund. That difficult performance over those 3 and 5 year timeframes has brought it onto that scorecard as a minor concern for performance. 10-year number really solid. Consistency generally is pretty solid, beating its peers in a 3-year time frame, 4 of the last 7 3-year time frames. So something we will just continue to watch, given that generally good consistency. Quick note on the international funds, as Rick noted, good performance in those categories. Both your active managers up more than 20% over the course of the last year. A little more modest performance for your Causeway fund. But their 3-year performance is outstanding. And actually, if we just roll this back a year, that 3-year performance that's now in the 75th percentile was actually in the 8th percentile. So a lot of endpoint sensitivity from what was really sort of a tough year in 25 and then so far this year. But on the flip side, your international growth fund, that Fidelity Diversified, strong performance across all time frames in the top 25% everywhere there. And then I think shifting gears a little bit, bottom of the page, we get into bonds and a lot less of absolute performance. Bond market still modest performance. PIMCO fund, a tough quarter. I'm in the 85th percentile. They really weren't positioned for those rising rates that we saw. Yields on bonds went up in the quarter, which means prices went down. That hurt this fund. But if you look at that 1, 3, 5, 7, 10-year number for PIMCO in the top 10%, so beating more than 90% of the bond managers out there over the long run. So great performance from PIMCO and truly one of the best bond managers out there. Also notable for really good cumulative long performance is your stable value fund. Actually, a pretty big part of the plan at about 18%. And as you can see, top 10 percentile across most of the time frames here. So really strong performance from Putnam on that front. And then really close with those American funds, your target date funds. Sort of a modest quarter for American funds, but very much explainable given by the structure of their assets. You know, as they get into those funds that are meant for those retiring in 2065, 2070, they hold a lot of those really rapidly growing mega-sized companies. And so that's really where they suffered. If you take a look at the quarter, you'll see in parentheses numbers 90%, 80s, high 80s. And that's where those large growth stocks turning down really hurt this particular suite. In the long run, very acceptable numbers for this. In many cases, top decile, but if not top decile, almost always at least top 40%. So very happy with what American funds does with the construction of those target date funds. So happy to take questions on any of that. I know a lot of numbers, but we would say other than that, Invesco developing market funds, pretty happy with everything that's in the plan at this point.
Okay, no one has questions. We will go on to item C3, staying with Innovest, emerging market fund manager search. And we'll give it right back to you.
Yep. Great, hope all can see that. I will handle this search and really a little bit of an introduction, just as a reminder. I think it's probably been a while since we've done the search, maybe even dating back to when we did the original searches as the plan was transitioned fully over to Empower. But this is a fiduciary responsibility of the board. So using a prudent process, and with that, you've sort of adopted Innovest process at looking the funds within the plan and sort of deciding what we should offer. And again, just a reminder, on this particular page, that it is an important role of your fiduciary responsibilities at taking a look at the investments within the plan. You know, this is our process. We really have no proprietary products. We have no affiliation with any products. Ultimately, we've got access to anything that Empower makes available on their platform. So truly tens of thousands of funds that are available for us to screen through. We do have certainly some quantitative screening to get down to what we like, some very high level elimination, but then we really get into digging into that criteria we showed on our manager scorecard and the evaluation of the organization, the people, their process and philosophy, their consistency. And then ultimately we look for an edge. Is a fund got greater resources than everyone else? Do they have a really strong process and philosophy that leads to greater performance? So what is it that gives them an edge over others, and ultimately the reason for us to bring them into to the plan? So today we're bringing forth actually one fund in this particular case. The fund is called DFA Emerging Market Core Equity Funds. So this is an emerging market funds from a firm called DFA or Dimensional Fund Advisors. Top numbers up top, a good size fund, $37 billion within assets, but not too big, we would say. That emerging market exposure is pretty big market at this point in time. A lot of holdings, which I'll talk about, more than 7,000 securities within this particular portfolio, so very broadly diversified, and that is one of their big themes for this particular fund. Inception goes back to 2005, so been around for more than 20 years. They tend to not turn over stocks too much, so not churning those stocks, not creating expenses by selling and buying stocks on a very regular basis. Tenured manager group and really managed, we would say, as a group and also as a firm using a very similar process through all the DFA investments. Purchase information shows, most importantly, that net expense ratio, modest expenses at 0.39%, really below where you are at this particular point for the Invesco fund. And then the good tenure team I talk about, again, lots of input from the rest of DFA, but these four individuals sort of leading the charge on this particular fund. As we think about their process, really the rules-based active screening that we note here is based on academic work by a couple individuals. These individuals are named Fama and French. Lots of academic work done by them. One of them was a professor at the University of Chicago, the other a professor at Northwestern, and they wrote many papers around the premiums that can be found if you invest in inexpensive stocks, as well as small companies. That really is the basis of this work. And that's where that active screening comes from. They look for very low book-to-market pricing, and they look to the smallest part of the capitalization market. Now, they do screen. It's also some highly regulated parts of the market, such as utility stocks and real estate stocks. And then they also have a little bit of a bias toward profitable companies. So companies that are showing profits versus those that don't show profits are a little bit of their investment work. Again, the process creates a portfolio that holds thousands of securities. That is the nature of this. They're just looking at inexpensive stocks and the smallest part of the markets that they're exposed to, and creating that really broadly diversified portfolio. Not much to note on this particular page. Again, showing those total securities. Lots of exposure really to the Asian Pacific. That's a big part of that emerging market economies, China, Taiwan, Korea, big parts. Also India, very big part of those emerging market economies. And similar to the U.S., information technology stocks, also a big part of that particular market, along with financials. So I think notable, and again, here you won't see big parts of the fund, big exposure to companies. You do see a couple larger companies with 6% and then 4% within the portfolio, but really fractional positions for most of the securities that are in the portfolio. So key considerations for the fund is it follows that academically based investment approach, heavily documented on that front, that really overweights toward those premiums that Fama and French found within the market, really creates, has created some long-term strong outperformance with those characteristics of inexpensive stocks and very small companies. They also use a very sophisticated quantitative trading model. So, you know, holding so many stocks, they're always looking at trading in and out minor positions within those stocks. They look to be very efficient, picking up fractional profits essentially in some of the trading that they're doing. So it's really quantitative trading models of added value over a period of time. Again, robust staff. The full firm of DFA is focused on this particular process and their quantitative models. So they are always looking to improve those models and roll out new ideas in that particular case. Again, the portfolio, again, they do focus in on the smallest part of each of those markets, the smallest companies, and in some cases that can be a volatile part of the market. So sometimes when the markets are down, they can be down a little bit more than the markets just due to that focus within the smallest part of those markets. And again, being very quantitative, the complexity of those dimensional algorithms can be tough to assess sometimes. That important scorecard, we would say, the DFA fund would come in with all green criteria in this particular case. And again, reflecting the Invesco challenges over a few different criteria there. And then really into performance, you know, we look at performance in a lot of different ways. Consistency over time is one of our key metrics. You know, we look at a rolling three-year time frame, sort of trying to capture a little bit of a market cycle. Knowing that funds will underperform in single calendar years at times, but over a market cycle, how well do they do? And then we'll look at those calendar years also. We do know that's important, and then we'll look at that cumulative performance. But this is the rolling three-year timeframes, best summarized on the bottom of this page. So we show that consistency, what we call that consistency count. This is what each fund that we're looking at, the DFA fund and then the Invesco Developing Market Funds, have done it both against the benchmark or the index that we index them against, as well as their peer group. So similarly managed funds, how have they done against that median or 50th ranked manager in that particular market? So DFA, good consistency here. They beat the benchmark in 7 of the last 10 rolling 3-year timeframes. They beat that median manager in 7 of the last 10 rolling 3-year timeframes. Less so for Invesco, beating the benchmark in 4 of 10 of those timeframes and behind the median manager in 4 of those 10 timeframes also. Calendar year timeframes, again, looking at the past 10, a little more modest numbers for DFA on that basis. And again, due to, I think, that volatility that we talked about of some of those small companies. They beat the benchmark in 4 of 10, but they show that, importantly, against that median manager of 7 of the last 10 calendar years, they've beaten that median manager. And then Invesco, again, modest counts here, 4 of 10 against the benchmark, 3 of 10 against that median manager for the existing fund. And really, that all adds up into the cumulative performance, ultimately showing DFA against Invesco over everything from a year to date out to 15 years. And those are annualized numbers. So those are per year over each of those, 7, 10, 12 year, 15 year numbers over on the far right hand side. Definite edge to DFA over that long run. Modest number over that 1 year time frame. But if we look at really the 5, 7, 10, 15-year numbers for DFA, ultimately within the top third over all those particular time frames, top 40% over that 3-year time frame. So that good consistency from DFA rolls up into really solid cumulative numbers. And just a couple pages, so bear with me. I think an interesting chart here and showing the challenges for Invesco. This we show when the markets move. How do these funds actually go down and up with the market? The black line is the Invesco fund and the one we're looking at replacing on the far right-hand side. You can see that black line goes down much further than the other two lines. The blue line is actually the index. The brown line is DFA. So you can actually see DFA in the more recent timeframes been sort of protective, has not gone down as much as the index and has not gone down certainly as much as the Invesco fund. So in the Invesco fund, really challenged in those negative markets that we've seen lately, DFA being a little bit protective. That's also ultimately, I think, reflective on this particular page. I'm only going to look at these charts on the right-hand side. This is the last 5 years. Ultimately, DFA plotting nicely in this top chart. So what we here show on this chart is the return of the DFA fund against the risk of the DFA fund. So when the return is being plotted on that left-hand column, we want to see that brown square up as high as we can in the chart. And then also, as we measure that risk on the bottom axis, we want to see that to the left if we possibly can. So where DFA plots, it means you're getting more risk than the index, than their peers, and that black dot, the Invesco fund. And it's actually doing so with a little bit less risk. So plots in a nice spot. The black dot is Invesco. It actually means it's not getting as much return as the index and peers, and it's doing so actually with a little bit more risk, sort of reflective of that last chart. And then the bottom chart just reflects what we call up-down capture. And this just means when the markets are going up, how much of the up market do you get? When the markets are going down, how much of the markets do you get? And I'll probably describe the DFA brown square is probably the best example. If you look at that up capture market, they get about 95% of the up capture. So if the index was up 10%, this fund would get about 9.5% in market return over the long run. That would be our expectation. If we think about the markets being down, they're right around that probably about 80% mark. So if markets were down 10%, we would expect this fund to maybe be down around 8%. And that's sort of reflective, again, of that line chart that we just saw. Invesco plotting in a little bit of a tough spot. They get less of the upside and more of the downside in that particular case. So that lower right-hand side, not a very attractive spot to plot in this particular case. The DFA fund showing is a little bit protective. So I think that's the bulk of what I wanted to cover. We do think the DFA fund would be a nice replacement for that Invesco fund. And again, comes along with a lot of nice characteristics, broad diversification, low cost, and certainly as we take a look at it at this point in time, some strong performance. So happy to take questions on that, but that's what we've got on that particular fund.
Rolf.
Yeah, I was just looking, and that's the DFCEX fund, right?
Yes.
Okay. I did a little check. It's not that we shouldn't invest in it, but I think it's just for full disclosure, in my little quick review, it looks like 22% of the fund is invested in Taiwan, and there's a lot of political buildup to China taking over Taiwan and things like that. And obviously, the companies that are there are high-quality companies, but I think it's just for informational purposes for people to recognize that you know, it could be a problem if China did decide to take over Taiwan.
Yeah, certainly warranted comment. You know, this is a fund that will look a lot like that index. So that index that this particular piece tracks, what's called the MSCI Emerging Markets Index, will be about the same exposure to Taiwan.
Yeah, and like I say, I don't think it's reason why not to, but it just to be aware of it. It could be concerning to some people.
Joby.
Yeah, question, and just to refresh my memory, I don't know if this will be for Gordon or maybe possibly Jeff at Empower, but could you tell me the process when we do vote to change a fund, how that affects our participants that are invested in that fund?
Yeah, I can and handle it, and Jeff can chime in as needed. Generally, it will be about a 60-day time frame or a little bit longer. So you would just make the decision to make that change. We'll work with Empower in making that change. They will pick a date, again, out around that 60-day time frame. They'll create a communication informing your participants that the change is being made. We can also create one a little more participant-friendly. We'll make the explanation talking about the struggles with the Invesco fund, can describe the DFA fund on a go-forward basis. But really, everything is done for them. So that date, 60-plus days out, ultimately, anybody that's invested in the Invesco fund right now, that afternoon, the change will be made. The next morning, they'll hold the DFA fund. So all the assets in the Invesco fund will be moved to the DFA fund. If they have new contributions flowing into the Invesco fund, any new contributions after that date will flow into the DFA fund. So really automated on really an asset transfer as well as investment election process. And plenty of communication available regarding the process.
Nothing to add. Nice job, Gordon.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure our money wasn't tied up or stopped kind of when we do some of those other changes, but appreciate it.
Nope, absolutely not. So just an overnight change.
Okay. Digesting all of this information, I am leaning towards, I will take a motion to either change or stand pat with Invesco.
Dennis, this is Joby. I'll go ahead and make a motion that we change from the Invesco to the DFA fund.
Second.
Okay, Joby made the motion and Joe made a second. We'll take a vote on this. Angel.
Aye.
Joby.
Aye.
Dennis. Aye. Terry.
Aye.
Lisa.
Aye.
Rolf.
Aye. I bet you thought I was going to say something different.
I don't bet. And Jason.
Aye.
All right. Motion passes 7-0. And I know that Jeff will take all the necessary steps to make this happen in 60-ish days.
Great. Thanks, all. I know it was a lot to get through with us, but do appreciate the time. And that's what we had to cover. So back to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Gordon. Okay, everyone take a deep breath. Okay, the It's on to item D, the Empower quarter, first quarter report. Jeff.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, the fund change has been noted, and I'll work directly with Gordon and Rick to get it within that 60-ish day timeframe for you all. Lisa, you can expect we have a fund change agreement, which would come to you in the next week or week and a half or so, just to confirm the change via signature. And then from there, that's pretty much all you need to do, and we'll move forward.
All right. I'll look out for it.
All right. So let's jump into the City of Tucson Plan Performance Insights Review for the first quarter of 2026. Do want to note here on page 3, we see participant assets of $346.2 million roughly. As Innovest pointed out, there was some volatility in the first quarter, especially in March. So the number you actually see here is at a pretty much a low point for the first quarter, because I think March 30th was the low. But just to kind of give you an update, the plans are now north of about $370 million combined. So April and May so far has been really good to us in terms of that market rebound. I'm going to jump specifically to the 457. As you can see there at the end of the first quarter, $339.7 million in the 457 with 4,194 participants with a balance. When we break that out between active and separated, we have 2,523 versus the 1,671. So pretty much flat from the end of the year when it comes to new participants in the plan versus those that may have left. Again, we're working in a very robust work economy. It's a you know, low fire, low hire environment. So we're not seeing a lot of participants with balances increase across any of our plans for the most part. So typical for what we're seeing. Moving on to the executive summary here, average balance for a Tucson participant, a little over 81,000. Does trail that benchmark of 90,000, but is catching up as we've seen over time over the last couple of years since being on the Empower platform. Moving on to investment strategy utilization. Again, we talked, Innovest talked about this in terms of, you know, a little bit of diversification and how those managed accounts and target date and online advice participants are, you know, taking advantage of some of that additional international exposure. So you can see there, you know, you've got 58, almost 60% of your participants in some sort of diversified portfolio across the board. Again, which would have given them probably more international exposure than normal do-it-yourselfers within the plan, which has really played out in terms of their increased account balances over time. Moving to account registration, just going to focus on the left-hand side here. We remain at 85% in terms of participants having a user ID and password for their account. What we've done differently on this report, instead of showing an overall snapshot of participants who have registered, we're breaking out between active and separated from service participants. So you can see there, 2,329 out of the 2,500 roughly active participants have registered their account. And then 1,226 out of the 1,671 separated participants have registered. Moving on to lifetime income score, median is at 66%, average at 75%. It is beating our median benchmark of 64%. So good to see there. It's always been right in line for Tucson participants on track to replace the income they had while working. So nothing notable there to mark. Moving on to cash flow for the 457, we'll focus on the right-hand side column here. Beginning of the quarter, we had $350.2 million. We had about $4.2 million in contributions, about $7.2 million in disbursements, fees $75,000, loans issued $475,000, loan payments $416,000, and then we saw that negative change in value of about negative $7.4 million. As always, I take a look at the disbursements to see if there's any type of anomalies. We did have a participant who had close to $1 million account move out to JP Morgan Chase. So I think that accounts for some of the distribution outflows there. The other interesting thing I noted is there was about 8 participants who rolled money to another qualified plan, meaning they went to go work somewhere else and took their funds with them to their new employer. So again, not necessarily to an IRA with a bank or any of that, but that accounted for about 700,000. So I guess the good news is, the bad news is the money rolled out, but the good news is they didn't go out to an IRA. They at least took it to their new employer to keep that money rolling at the new place. Oops, sorry. Going to take a look at contribution rate. So average that we have on our record keeping system is at 7.1%, pretty close to our benchmark of 7.3%. Down at the bottom there, you can see the representative changes quarter over quarter for the percentages that participants are changing. Again, if they have a flat dollar amount in our system, that we're converting that to a percentage based off of the salary that's being fed to us. So that's why you see everything in percentage there. But did not see any drastic changes across the board for any of these percentages. So again, nothing notable there. Money type utilization. I love this one because it's since Tucson's come over to us, right? We see where that Roth only and those multiple type buckets are growing. So again, at Mission Square, you basically had your Roth IRAs and that's where your contributions were going to. Now we're keeping those contributions within the plan. But if we break this out, you can see about 1,700 participants are before tax. We have 439 participants contributing to Roth only. And then we have our 213 participants who have multiple types. So again, going to both pre-tax and Roth, taking advantage of, again, having Roth within the plan, having multiple types, using our engine to determine if having multiple types or Roth only is good for them. And then obviously Keening's having conversations as well too with individuals as to whether or not they should do multiple Roth or pre-tax only. Contribution activity, we'll focus on the year to date here. So again, we have about 3 million in participant before tax, about 600,000 in Roth. The other category strong for the first quarter, 638,000. Those are rollovers into the plan. So again, as Keenan's having conversations with new hires and also existing employees, right? We're always wanting to discover if there's any other outside assets that they've got at other employers that they'd like to roll in and take advantage of. So we brought in about 638,000 in the first quarter. Distribution activity, talked about it a little bit at a high level, but again, here's all some of the reasons year to date for individuals taking money out of the plan. Separation from service. We had RMDs are popular in the beginning of the year. We have our in-service distributions. So that could be age 59 and a half, et cetera. Hardships for about 27,000. Purchase of service credits, people buying pension time, whether it's for, the Tucson pension or, the Arizona pension. We saw about 147,000 go out for that. About 56,000 in quadros, so separation of accounts due to the divorce, 391,000 in death, and then we have some other miscellaneous stuff, about 11,000, totaling that 7.2 million for the quarter. Loans, gonna jump to this page. Take a look at loan activity.
Jeff.
Yes.
I have a question. Do we have any rules on owning controversial stock like Palantir? I know it's not like climate or anything like that. I just didn't know. I mean, it's kind of controversial. I don't know if it's political. I just was wondering.
I missed the question, Lisa.
Palantir, owning stock in Palantir.
I don't know.
I don't know if the city has any. I don't think so, but maybe I'm just asking. I was just asking. I don't know.
Yeah, so I don't remember.
Cassie, maybe we don't have anything like that. I was just curious.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Because we did have the discussion about, because mayor and council wanted some involvement one or two meetings ago. But I think since it's individuals' money, as opposed to TSRS, where mayor and council can have a direct say so. Yeah, so
Got it.
My presumption is if you're doing self-directed brokerage, if it's out there, it's
right.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you.
That's correct, Dennis. Yeah, I think with the committee, I determined that because this is, you know, DC assets and not, you know, city right. funds, that participants can direct that. Now, I don't remember. I think maybe Gordon did an analysis to see whether if that stock was held in any of the mutual funds. I don't remember the outcome of that. But again, it was kind of a moot point because, participants are being directed or directing their investments.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the last meeting that I participated in with the city, the goal was to restructure that entire inquiry. And one of the recommendations in the restructure would be to exclude 457 assets from the analysis. I don't know if the city made those changes or not.
Thank you.
All right, moving back into loans here. Nothing stood out in terms of new loans issued for the first quarter. We can see January had 18, February had 17, March had 19. And if we take a look at the, you know, trending 12 months, nothing jumps out as any different there. We've talked about investment strategies. Just going to want to take a look a little bit more at advisory services to provide you an update here. So as we can see here, again, we talked about having, you know, 27.9% of your participants enrolled in managed accounts. Again, it's very important that we have participants engage with the managed accounts, right? Understanding that they are paying a fee and that there are certain requirements that we want to have captured in order to build the best portfolio for them. So the good news is we got about 61% of participants. So 715 out of those 1169 have confirmed or further personalized those managed account inputs. This next slide, as you've seen many times before, this is what we start with. This is what we've got on our record keeping system already. So we start with a pretty good set of assumptions. But what we really want participants to engage is getting into some of these other categories, right? So changing their projected retirement age, their retirement income need, adding other accounts, adding pension, adjusting their Social Security estimates if it applies. So we can see that 21.3% of members have confirmed and kept the default for these categories, when 57% of members have customized a value for at least one of the inputs shown. So good activity there. And then additionally, you know, we've got ways for individuals to further interact with managed accounts. So it's not just about the income. It's also about personalizing the expenses. How long is your money going to last based off of what you're projected to get? So we've got about 41% of participants who have added their expenses into their projections, added other income outside of the pension. So that could be, hey, I want to account for my spouses as well. And then we have risk constraints, and then also you can change your life expectancy as well too, if you know, if you have any medical conditions. So overall, good interaction for the managed account personalization. I know that's a focus of Keenan if he's meeting with somebody that's already in managed accounts, right, and has had it previously with Mission Square and came over to Empower, has not updated any of that information. He's making sure that that's getting inputted. Okay, going to jump lastly. I know we've got a lot of topics here for the rest of the meeting. So just going to go to the Empower Communications Engine. Here again, just showcasing that all of the ways that we can communicate with your participants are turned on. We break it out into those three buckets, sort of the getting started, welcome to your plan, add a beneficiary, register your account, etc. Saving and investing, right? Do you need help investing? Should you be saving more, etc.? And then also the planning and optimizing. So again, boosting your financial wellness. Again, that can, whether you're in managed accounts or not, you can still aggregate your other assets as well as expenses. Get help with financial planning, because that is an option for the city of Tucson. And then taking a look at your retirement options and being ready for retirement. But where that rubber really meets the road, I like to showcase on this page, right? So on the left-hand side, we've We kind of show some of the stats for the year. We've got 57 new participants with a balance year to date, 278 have added or updated contact information. We have 80 new registries for online accounts, and then 111 have added or updated their beneficiary. Moving on to saving and investing, we've had 204 increase their deferral. That was just in the first quarter, so great to see. Hopefully that trend continues and we beat that 505 deferral increases for 2025. 21 have moved to using a guided investment strategy. So again, that's whether it's target date or the risk-based model. 40 have enrolled in managed accounts, and then 50 have personalized their managed account profile. And then moving on to the right-hand side, engaging with our website, app, or a call center representative. In the first quarter, we had 1,389 folks engage with Empower in one of those mediums. 39 have set up their Empower personal dashboard. Again, that's some of that aggregation and drawdown tools that we have. And then 9 have consolidated assets within your plan. So we saw that 638,000 coming for the first quarter. That was across 9 individuals for you all. Any questions on the 457? Yeah, a little bit of a tough quarter in terms of market performance, but we're right back where we were and plus, at least through market close yesterday. Real quickly, just going to go over the 401A in terms of assets and participants. 5.1 million in the 401A with 40 participants across the board. So no additional participants in this plan. And then if I jump all the way to the 401A executives, just to show you the high level of that, got about 1.3 million in participant assets with a new 401A key executive in the plan, bringing us to a total of 6.
401A allow people to sell their
stuff. So
do it.
I don't know.
I'm sorry. Did somebody have a question?
This is Brian Jeffries. I was asking the chair if your plan allows for sick leave sellback rollovers into the 401A.
I believe those are going into the 457. I got to double check the document, Brian. Yeah. I get a lot of these rules mixed up with a lot of plans, so I usually have to go back and review it. Keenan, you popped in.
Correct.
So you're telling me you've got an answer.
Vacation and sick goes to 457 almost always. We rarely mess with the 401A when it comes to contributing to it. Usually that's one of the bigger reasons for the special catch up.
Yep.
Gotcha.
Okay. Any question? Oh, Don, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you can't roll anything into the 401. Everything that goes into the 401 has to be done at the time of enrollment.
Right. So, Brian, I think that's the difference, is that Tucson really adheres to the 401A rules. Like, if you didn't get into the plan at new hire, right, within that first window of opportunity, then it closes for folks. Yeah.
I see. Yeah, that's just different than what I've seen in several other cities, so I was curious.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any questions on any of the plans? Okay. I have one more item on just the Empower part of the agenda, and that's the new Empower Personal Dashboard. Going to briefly go over this. I usually just highlight a couple of slides here, but I like jumping to this one first. So first and foremost, as Empower continues to build out our capabilities, we are going through a new website. I'm going to call it Refresh. Tentatively, our government plans are scheduled for the third quarter of 2026. And I say tentatively because as we test things and we build them out, there have been a couple of pushes by a couple of weeks. So don't hold me to the third quarter. But the idea behind this refresh is, again, we know that participants are engaging with us either on our website or through mobile apps more and more, as you can see from some of the stats before. And on the left-hand side here, you see this screenshot About a decade or so ago now, we came out with the lifetime income score. And again, that was to help participants project an income they have for retirement, right? Because before, as record keepers, including ourselves, right, we would just show a balance and people would ask us, well, that's great, I see my balance, but how do I turn that into an income? What does that do for me? So we created the lifetime income score. As we moved into the versions you see today, as we've been updating, right, we still have the lifetime income score front and center, but we've added, you know, the account aggregation and the messaging. And it's, you probably agree, because I think the same way, it's really busy and it's hard to digest a lot of the information when you land on the homepage, right? So we've taken that feedback to heart. And part of this new Empower personal dashboard will kind of get out to what you see on the right hand side there, right? So a simplification of all the information you see on the landing page, right? So the good news is that all those features and benefits, we're not stripping them away. They're still going to be there. But the feedback we got was, well, hey, you know, much like my Instagram or my TikTok, or if you're reading something on a mobile device, right, you kind of have to scroll up to continue to get to where you want to get to. So that's the idea that we're going with here, is that all that information is still there that you see today, right? It's just going to be shifted down to lower parts of the page where you do have to scroll through. Again, going to make things a little bit cleaner for participants, with the idea of that it's going to be a little bit more actionable. So some of the things that you can see here, it's a little bit small, but when you log on, again, you're going to see your net worth, and right under that, there's going to be a couple of, you know, markers that show the accounts that you have with us, whether it's 457B or 401A. Any other outside accounts you've aggregated. And at the top, we're going to have some insights. So this is where kind of AI comes into play. So we've talked about our Empower communications engine and how that's unique to participants based off of where they're at in their working career. These insights are going to get even a little bit more deeper into participants' behavior, right, within the plan. And again, always having that idea that if a participant wants to take action on any of those insights, they're just going to be one click away on that box, and it's going to take them to exactly where they need to be. Additionally, on the right hand side, and this is something that I welcome, is that if you currently have a transaction that's pending with Empower, whether it's a loan or withdrawal, etc., we're going to show the status of that distribution or loan or whatever it may be on the right hand side, so that you know that at any moment in real time you can go in and check the status of that, which is really cool, because I think that's going to start slowing down some of the calls that we get trying to find status of these certain distributions or loans, whatever that may be. We've already got text message alerts to do that, but not a lot of people, you know, affirmatively elect to have these text messages sent to them. So this is just one way where everyone can see their transactions on the website. Then just kind of going to go back to this here. It just kind of really comes back to three points, right? So we're going to clear out the financial clutter. That's bullet point number one. You know, so we can have a unified experience for benefits, wealth, and personal finances. Simplifying the visuals so we can bring clarity to the financial help. And then again, I talked about that guidance in terms of the insights, but this is a little bit better of a screenshot here where you can kind of see what you're going to land on for the landing page. That's going to make it a little bit cleaner and actionable for participants. So we wanted to provide you that update. When this goes live, we will have messaging for individuals. Now, it's not going to come in the terms of a campaign, hey, go check out the new Empower website. It's going to be when people log in, right? There's going to be post-login messaging saying, welcome to your new Empower personal dashboard, so they're not caught off guard when they see things different. And that's just to give them the alert that they are in the right place, but some of the tools and features have moved or been simplified. Any questions around that? I'm excited to see it for your participants. I've been using it myself. They rolled it out for the Empower 401k staff plan for us to, you know, tinker with it, provide feedback, see what's working, see what's not working. We've seen a lot of good outcome from that. But as a big proponent of the website, I had already everything entered. It carried over, which was nice. And then I just made some slight adjustments as the new website came out. Any comments or questions from anybody on the dashboard?
Okay.
All right, Mr. Chair, that's my update for the Empower agenda item.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Jason.
Yes. Hey, I had a shout out for Jeff, not about the dashboard. I just wanted to do a quick shout out to Jeff. At the request of a bunch of our plan participants, we asked Jeff to look into a PEHP, post-employment health plan. And I won't get into all of that now, but Mr. Chairman, at the end of the meeting, I will be asking for us to talk about that at a future meeting. I know it's not agendized now, but Jeff and his team did a whole bunch of great research really quickly. And I really appreciate it. And so do the participants that reached out to me. And so I'm looking forward to a discussion on that, both at the end of this meeting and on a future agenda. So thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, you're welcome, Jason. Brian, that kind of ties back into your comment there. You know, the city's potentially trying to find another option to dump that sick and vacation into. So it's not just the 457, but if they want to use it for medical expenses, then potentially they'll have that option in the future.
Very good.
Okay. We are on to agenda item E. E1, the brokerage window service provider. We've been talking about this for 9 months now, I think. I think we should come to a conclusion today. So, I know we've gone back and forth on this. We have, I think last count, 93 employees that are involved with this. We do understand that it's being pushed by an outside advisor because most of the people that are in the brokerage account are public safety employees or retirees. But I do realize, and we've discussed this, that it's going to come, if we do decide to make the change, it's going to come with a significant cost. There will be cost to city staff, time and money. There will be cost to Empower, which would, of course, we would have to absorb because it is a big plan change. And I know Jeff has some data on costs, and I know that we'd be talking about blackout periods and the potential to not make money during the blackout period. So I guess I'd like Jeff to start, and maybe if you can just throw some numbers at us, and if we were to make the change, what would happen from the Empower perspective?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So at the committee's request, I went back and did some research in terms of time and cost for this potential change. Came up with a couple of things. As we've noted, it's an out of scope change. This has not been built into our P&L in the current 5-year contract. So wanted to start with that. In terms of a transition, let's start with timing. So we can expect that this entire process from start to finish would be 90 to 120 days, right? And what that's going to entail is an update to the service agreement, which I really don't see being an obstacle because it's really just changing a paragraph or two within our service agreement. Not a big deal. Additionally, there's going to be some paperwork that needs to be filled out for Schwab in terms of doing business with them. Additionally, that Schwab paperwork is also going to include how you want the Schwab brokerage to be set up, which is, I'm sure, probably going to be the same as how you have it with the Empower brokerage. So that's just going to be a pickup of, you know, let's take a look at what we're doing here and just map it over to the Schwab contracts and also the setup. So I don't see that part being a significant hindrance to all of this because, again, it's just a small part of the overall contract. So you mentioned, so I mentioned 90 to 120 days, right? So generally, that's going to be obviously because of setup time. So individuals being set up on or being assigned on the Empower side, and then obviously some individuals being set up on the Tucson side to communicate at least an hour every week leading up to the change. You mentioned a blackout. So I talked to our team and they said it would be like a normal blackout for any type of transition we do. So, you know, consider when you guys moved over from Mission Square, you know, we quoted a 7 to 10 day blackout period. I think it ended up being more closer to the 7, but we can anticipate for that window of time, individuals not being able to transact within their self-directed brokerage window because we've got to shut everything off, reconcile, pick the assets up in kind. So there's not going to be any selling of the investments within the brokerage to move it in cash to Schwab and then reinvest. It's just going to be an in-kind pickup during that time. So any questions on timing? Okay, so now I'll jump to cost. So as mentioned, it was out of scope, right? So in talking with our project management team, who will have to assign somebody there, we'll have to get somebody from self-directed brokerage. We have to get somebody from our investment team, and we have to get someone from our systems team set up. And then also taking into account marketing, and that's why I'm going to quote an amount or a range, because it's all going to depend on how this gets communicated, whether it's email, all mail, whether it's all participants or just impacted participants. We're looking at a total cost of anywhere from $17,500 to $20,500. So we can go about that a couple of ways, right? You've got one of two ways for me is obviously the city has to absorb that out of scope cost somehow. I'll defer to Cassie on whether something like that can come out of the plan expense account as an option. And then additionally, what we could potentially propose is Empower absorbing the cost. But what we would ask for consideration for extending our current contract. But again, I've got to be mindful of any procurement rules that Tucson has as well, too. So don't want to provide that as an option that, you know, may or may not be viable depending on what rules you have.
Thanks, Jeff. So, Cassie, real quick, can we answer that question? I mean, the 20,000, if that could, can that come out of the plan assets?
It can come out of the expense fund that's available. So I just want to be careful for our minutes that it wouldn't come out of plan assets in terms of a charge to participants, but it could come out of that expense account. Yeah.
Out of the, which currently I think is about 355,800.
Yes. And the board has talked before about finding ways proactively to spend that down. So I would be comfortable paying that from that account.
Okay. Which would bring my perspective to, I mean, 20,000 isn't a lot when we've got 370 million. I would just wonder, we've got approximately 4,200 people on the plan, and this is going to be for the benefit of 90 people. I don't know how other plan participants would feel about that. But then again, like I say, that's it's pennies in the big picture.
Right. And just in terms of the cost, the fact that this is a targeted project for a very small percentage of the participants doesn't affect whether it's an eligible cost or not. Now, it might affect the board's decision about whether the cost should be incurred because it's a relatively large expense per person. right, mm-hmm. for the people that use the service. But in terms of whether it's permissible to use those expense account funds to pay it, the small number of participants wouldn't change my decision. There are lots of particular projects in plan administration that might not affect a large group of people, but need to be done.
Okay. Thanks. Lisa?
From my perspective, I'm going to say that I don't believe that it's in the plan's best interest to change the brokerage window for a very small group of participants. And there's 4,200 participants, there's been no, that are very satisfied with the Empower services. We've had no complaints. We've had very good relationship with Empower. And to change, make this huge change for less than 100 employees is the changing of the providers would create additional administrative complexity to our services, increase our staff workload, and it could potentially impact plan fees to our participants. I just don't feel that with that operational burden and the cost implications that it just outweighs the benefit. So I don't. Not at this point. I can't. But that is my stance on this.
Okay. Jason?
I guess my question is if Galloway or would want to be interested in maybe cost sharing this or absorbing the cost.
So if they were, I mean, how would we go about, who would approach them? I guess is probably my primary, who would approach them and say, hey, it's the people you advise that would like this, or you're willing to share in the cost. But is that something that the city would do, Empower, or how would that communication be initiated?
I'm happy to speak on this. Oh. If you would allow me to. In fact, I'd love an opportunity to speak on this entire topic if you'd allow me to.
Yeah, I just have one question really quick. Jeff, how much is it going to cost me? I'm just curious. I'm a participant in deferred comp, so... am I going to get charged more fees if we have a different brokerage window?
No, we're not changing any of that from that perspective. So right now you guys are at $36 per participant per year. None of that changes. That's where the out of scope cost comes into play. So additionally, as I mentioned, you know, if you were looking to extend the contract, we could absorb that into a longer number of years. Another option that I didn't put onto the table was if we absorbed that, then we would have to change the record keeping fee and have it go north. But I don't think, you know, there was an appetite for that. So I didn't bring it. So there's no change in cost for what you're doing, Lisa, even though you don't use the self-directed brokerage account.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, you've got a question from Joby before we turn to Brian.
I've been waiting for Jason. Are we done? Jason had two hands up. That's all. He's just checking. Okay.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yes. Let me.
You good? Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Joby.
Well, and I was the one that brought this forward to the board, and it was at the request of Galloway Financial. And so I did want to see, Mr. Chairman, if you would entertain, since Brian is in the room from Galloway, to better explain what the actual issues are that we're dealing with for these 93 people, since they, you know, assist about 75% of them. So if we could hear from Brian to hear what the actual issues are, and then we could also maybe get into Jason's cost sharing question with him since he's in the room.
I'm unless if there's no legal reason that he can't talk, I would gladly entertain and hear what Brian has to say.
I don't have any concern with it, Mr. Chair. It's properly agended, and he's here as a potential interested provider.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak. This is a little bit of a homecoming for me because I worked for the city of Mesa for almost 30 years, and I was the chairman of our deferred comp committee for our department, and had the great experience of working with Innovest, an exceptional consultant, was our consultant as well, had the great experience of working with Empower as well, and also got to work with Cassie a lot over the years. So you guys have a dream team, let me tell you. Mm-hmm. I've worked with a lot of folks. You guys have a great team here. I'll take that a step further because I will tell you I'm not very good at retirement. Ever since leaving the city, I've been teaching deferred compensation now throughout the country. In fact, I've taught at NAGDA and in a lot of other forums throughout the nation. And I will tell you, as a little pat on your backs, about 80% of the cities, towns, counties, fire districts throughout the country don't have a committee, they don't use a consultant, and they've never been out to bid. And when we would get them, teach them to go down the path you've gone, we averaged 72% reductions in fees and dramatic improvements in share classes and investments. So congratulations to you guys on building a fantastic. My role now is, as I mentioned, is education. I teach all over the country. I teach all over the state of Arizona. And we have a contract with the Arizona Public Safety Personnel Retirement System to provide that education. And where this really came on my radar is interacting with some of your Tucson police officers and the ones that do use self-directed brokerage. So in every plan that I've been a part of, I was the chair of the Mesa plan. I was also on the PSPRS plan, which is newly formed out of pension reform in 2017. We use Schwab self-directed brokerage, okay? And when I started hearing complaints about the brokerage plan that you all have, I looked into it. And I wanted to see for my own eyes what the differences are. And I will tell you, I would strongly promote to you all is an opportunity to put on the screen some of the dramatic differences between the plans. I mean, just to be blunt about it, the Schwab plan, the Schwab platform is like a 2026 Corvette compared to a 2005 Corvette. And I have some of that documentation. And in fact, in a recent conversation with Kelly Bush at Empower, he talked about phasing out their current self-directed brokerage platform, which was designed by Pershing. It was white labeled by Empower, but it was designed by Pershing. So let me just give you one example. I can show you on my phone if you like, but just when it comes to research, regardless of who's doing whether it's a person doing their own account or whether it is an advisor working with them, which we're not the only ones, by the way. Summit Global is another one here locally that works with some of your employees. There are others, and they all have had these same issues. But if you look at the differences between what is available for just research alone, I'll show you. If you go on a Schwab, let's say your research or mutual fund, this is the level of research you get of information about that fund. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now let's compare that to that's what you get under the Pershing platform. Okay, it takes you outside the site, mm-hmm. and it takes you to the FINRA website. So this is an example of what you get with Schwab. Say you're an employee and you want to do some of your own self-directed mm-hmm. investing. This is the research you get. Now, this is what you get with Pershing, okay? Mm-hmm. It is very limited. It provides no stochastic information, et cetera. I don't know if I can do this for y'all.
Shu, do you want me to put it on the screen?
If that's possible, that would be great.
Or if Brian can log into the meeting, he may be able to share it. But I don't want to slow down the discussion either too sure. much.
Okay.
I think what he just showed us is a whirlwind difference in what the website shows as far as information regarding a particular security.
Correct.
I mean, he just showed just one screen looks like the Encyclopedia Britannica, and the Pershing looks like Reader Digest.
Thank you for that. That's just one of many, many issues that our folks have. Another one is just setting up the accounts. If they do work with an advisor, regardless of who it is, in some cases, getting these accounts set up is taking not hours, not days, but months. In addition to that, if they do work with an advisor, if they want to make trades within their account, that is having been put in a spreadsheet and sent by email to make a trade. I mean, we're talking 15 years ago technology versus being within the Schwab platform and be able to make trades real time within the platform. I mean, I could go on, but I think that's why even Kelly Bush mentioned that they're going to phase out this program at some point. And I don't think they're introducing it in any new plans, but the Schwab platform, for those who use it, is the most robust platform. Schwab and Fidelity, very similar, but the power of the information that you can receive and the ability to make trades real time, et cetera, are just night and day. And so I would caution you all, yes, our company works with a lot of your employees, but there are other companies that do too. And I've spoken to them and they also agree that this platform is just archaic and cumbersome. And I think you're the only ones in the state of Arizona that use it. I know in every city that I've worked with, that's particularly a lot of those that use Empower, including our city in Mesa, they use the Schwab platform. Yeah. So I thank you so much for letting me speak. I know.
Mr.
Chair?
Yeah.
While we're discussing.
We've got a question from Rolf, and then I had a follow-up question for Brian.
Okay, so while Brian's logging in, I saw Rolf's hand up because I know that Rolf is involved in such things. Rolf.
Thank you. Basically, I'm not wouldn't dispute the platform. I think Schwab is a better platform. My concern is with the disruption of service. Is that disruption only for the people that are in their brokerage, or if it is it with everyone in the plan?
Rolf, I was told it was just for the brokerage folks.
And how many are just in the brokerage?
We've been throwing out a number of about 90, but let me go back to the reports real quick.
I think there's 93 in the last one I looked at this past week. But still, it's 93. It's very little.
So if... So this disruption is only for those people using the brokerage. It's not going to. So basically, it's not affecting the majority of people, just the 90 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me confirm. But that's what I was told. But I didn't get that in writing. So let me double check, Rolf, if I can, real quick.
I think that's like the turning point for me. I mean, if it's affecting everyone, that's a big thing. It's affecting 90 people, and I really think Schwab is a better brokerage by quite a bit. That would probably be the thing that would sway me.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Please.
I'm kind of agreeing with Rolf. I'm just wondering if the costs can be absorbed by that. That's kind of where I was going with my question is, I mean, I'm assuming these are very, active investors and retiree, active, employees and retirees. And I'm just wondering if Galloway and that pool of people could absorb the cost.
Okay, there we go.
Like I realize that the 20,000 is not a large amount compared to what we have but I agree and disagree with Cassie. It is a lot for that few people, in my opinion.
Yes.
Jason, you're saying it's a lot for the 90 people to spend? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying that. Let me see if I'm saying that that seems like a large cost for us to absorb for us as the plan to absorb for that few people.
Yeah, I will say it is.
So I, I'm you know, I'm not saying
I think, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I think it's important for the cost analysis to remember that this would be, it sounds like, a plan enhancement. I think that there's some pretty consistent comment that the Schwab platform is better, more user-friendly, more helpful for the investors. It is only used by about 93 people now, but it is available across the plan. So the it has an impact to 93 approximately people right now, but it is also potentially a service enhancement for the entire plan.
Yeah, so if I can add to that, one of the things that is really important is this is going to start being more amplified. And the reason is every single new person that joins the PSPRS because of pension reform now has a defined contribution plan through PSPRS that's going to be added to their overall benefit profile. And in that, they are being exposed now because that plan has the Schwab. They're being exposed to that far more robust platform in their 401(a) plan. And so when they come back to your Citi plan and try to use the brokerage through Pershing, they're seeing a dramatic difference. And that's why we're getting an uptick in these comments, because they're going, holy cow, this is so much better what I have through my Nationwide account than what I'm getting, you know, that's through PSPRS than what I'm getting here in the Citi. And it is a plan enhancement by far. And that's why I think there's going to be just more and more intensity around this conversation. And yes.
Does anyone see the screen?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, so this, what I'm showing you here is the very limited research that is available through the current brokerage platform. I mean, this is a JP Morgan U.S. equity fund class fund, okay? Now, if you contrast that with Schwab, this is the type of information you're getting through the Schwab platform. This, you get in-depth research, in-depth information, major comparisons. Like I said, this is a 2026 Corvette versus a 2005. It's just far more robust. It's the best in the world. And that's why every other city around the state that has brokerage is using it.
And Joe.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Does this mean that if we engage this other brokerage firm, that all members of this plan can utilize this service, one? And number two, does that also mean, what does that mean to the 457? What would that mean for the 457 contribution of members? Or whatever contributions they make, Roth or 457.
I'll answer that. So self-directed brokerage window is an option that all participants have today. As we've talked about, only about 100 use it. So when you're moving platforms, everybody's going to, again, have access to, instead of Empower Brokerage, the Schwab Brokerage, but specifically those 100 that are using it now are getting the difference. There's no impact to contributions of the 457 plan. It's just you can just like you guys did an investment change right now, right? For on the DFA, right? You're just now swapping out the self-directed brokerage. It's just not as simple as the 60-day swap out. It takes a little bit more work.
And if I can add to that, a lot of plans don't have a self-brokerage option. It is not a required component of a plan. It is an additional benefit that is available in this plan. I certainly don't have a problem with it. I'm not being negative about it being in existence, but it is not a core offering of necessarily a 457 plan. So here, just the existence of the brokerage window is an extra benefit available to all plan participants. And what we're talking about is, you know, just changing what that benefit looks like, what the user experience is, if if one of your participants elects to go into the brokerage window. So there's never any requirement that it be used, but if you make the change, it would be available to every one of your employees who wants to go into the brokerage window. And in my experience, the number of folks who use a brokerage window across all types of plans is always relatively small. There are certain groups of employees. For example, if you look at a hospital's plan, you may see a larger percentage of people who use the brokerage window because it's popular among healthcare professionals. It might also have the same kind of results when you look at public safety. It depends on whether there are advisors who are working with the employees, who are helping them use the tool, learn about the tool. But across the board, across the country, most people aren't using a brokerage window in their employer plan. So even with a better platform, I think that the number of people in the Tucson program that use it is likely to stay small. To me, this is a question of whether you want to enhance the option for whoever may choose to use it.
So when we look at it that way and come back to the focus that it is available to everyone, it's the participant's choice to use or not use it. So maybe it really comes down to the time, the cost, and who's going to absorb the cost at this point. You know, like Jeff said, they could absorb it if we possibly make a change to our agreement. We haven't approached Galloway, or we have our plan assets.
I will say, if the cost factor that Jeff is talking about, I think it was $17,000, is that what I heard?
17 to 20.
I mean, that's something that our company would happily help with. I mean, it's such a low amount for the assets for our customers to be able to utilize such a dramatic improvement in their service. Oops, sorry about that. I'm moving while my screen's moving. But without question, we'd be glad to help with that.
Yes, it would have to come from another funding source. The city wouldn't be able to.
Well, no, our plan assets, we have plan assets to cover. Again, that's. Still, it's an everybody plan.
Most plans, it's the same pot that you use to send you.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's like the same pot of the administrative pot you use, like to send you to.
Yes, to NAGDA, right.
So, and in terms of the cost too, I just want to be clear: the expense, if the board authorizes the change, the expense is an expense billed by Empower to the city. Then the question is, how is that paid? Yeah. If there is funding available from Galloway, that reduces the city's cost. If the city wants to pay it through the expense account, that works also. But I want to be really clear that, of course, a contribution from Galloway doesn't give any special access to plan participants or any special relationship. It would be a very voluntary contribution from Galloway to assist its current clients with improving their service within the Tucson plan. Okay.
I agree with
Right.
Hey, Rolf. Sorry, Cassica.
No, just I think I just need to reiterate that because of how the question came about and where some of the complaints have originated within one group of the city's employees in the public safety sector, this has, in a sense, been understood as something that just will benefit those 93 people. And again, I don't know of the 93 people how many are in the public safety group. I don't know how many use Galloway, but I want to be really clear that this is a service available to everyone in the plan. And just like Roth deferrals are available to everyone in the plan, but only 15% of the population use them, it is a plan feature. So I really encourage the board to consider whether it's appropriate without focusing on which individuals are using it right now.
Yes.
Thanks for that, Cassie.
Okay, Roth. Both.
Yeah, thank you. I think for me, I always think in these terms, is it defendable to make this change, right? And I think, and I'm not trying to delay the next meeting, but for me to make it defendable, I think we need to have some type of document that has a side-by-side analysis of these two brokerages. In other words, what their capabilities is, maybe cybersecurity, operational issues, and then how many people are in the plan. I think we need to have some documentation so that it can be incorporated into the notes, so that if this voted yes or no, that the board has taken due diligently and not made any haste decision, and they have the information kind of lined out for them. Does that make sense?
Yes. Joby.
I'd like to follow up to that, because I feel like we have been talking about this for 9 months. We did have Innovest provide us a document of the pluses and minuses of the plans, you know, that they're similar and how the issues were. So I feel like, in my opinion, we do have that information. My only question, and I think Jeff has answered it, but maybe was going to follow up with some more of, you know, the blackout period, it only affects the brokerage window. So even those 93 participants, they might be in regular funds as well. Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong. That wouldn't be blacked out. It's just the money that's in the brokerage window at that time, correct?
Yeah, I'm trying to confirm that. I've got two messages, and I put the call on hold to try and call somebody, but they were unavailable. So I'll find that out and shoot that out as soon as possible.
And then my second part to that is I appreciate what Cassidy has said of, or sorry, Catherine has said on, you know, this is a plan enhancement, and so we can use some of our funds, but also it is a large amount to me to what we have. And so I do appreciate what Galloway or Brian has said, that Galloway would step up to cover some of those costs. So I think we could incorporate that into a motion. And I don't know if we're done with discussion or where we can go from there.
There's someone else who has their hand raised.
Dawn. I just wanted to let you guys know that I'm about to send out an email with the information that Innovest provided in February on comparing the service providers.
Can we get that on the screen?
Yes, Lisa should be able to share it from the S drive.
I can't. My computer died.
Oh, okay. Well, let me try to share it then.
I can work on that for you as well.
Thank you, Don.
Oh, you're much faster.
Oh, look at that.
There you go.
I'm going to stop moving it around. Let me know if you guys want me to put up anything else, but I did send out that email with this attached.
Thank you.
To all the board members, not everybody in the meeting.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Please, yes.
I want to be respectful of my fellow board member. Rolf, if this document here answers some of your questions, then I think I'm in a place where I'm going to go ahead and make a motion.
Well, it may, but a fast reader, but I'm not sure if I'm that fast.
Okay. We'll give a minute for everyone to digest this screen.
What does that mean if we're down the road and power is replaced? What does that mean for the Charles Schwab brokerage?
Important point.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I'll just say, Rolf, that I think any major record keeper you're going to work with probably has Schwab as an option if you were to, you know, decide to leave Empower. Yeah. So Nationwide uses
maybe maybe Investo can chime in on that.
They're not here.
I think he meant Innovest.
Innovest, yes.
Yeah, we would agree. We would say that the Schwab PCRA is the gold standard with self-directed brokerage accounts. It is the most widely used, along with Fidelity. And Fidelity, just because Fidelity has, they're the largest record keeper. They have more retirement plans. But if we look broadly across, say, 20 of the top record-keeping firms in the country, the vast majority use the Schwab PCRA.
Okay. Any more discussion, questions?
I'll just say that I'm satisfied now, I think, with the fact that we won't be charged any individual fee, or that fees will increase, that it'll be available for everybody. Yes, there'll be some staff labor involved, like everything else, but that's okay. So thank you for your explanation, Brian.
And Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to confirm that Galloway will be contributing towards the fees. Is that correct?
Yes, we work with Empower quite often, and so we could probably work that out with Empower directly. It makes it easier for the city and not having to go through, you know, the bureaucracy, if you will.
Okay, so do you know how much, what percentage of these fees Galloway would be willing to cover?
Jeff, if I may, what was the amount again?
17.5 to 20,500.
Yeah. There's a variance there because of the, depending on how marketing gets approached.
We can cover that. It's not a problem.
So is Galloway agreeing to cover that full cost?
Yes. It is so much better for your participants. That is money well spent from our part to make sure they have such a better program.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes. Well,
Brian, go ahead, Angel.
No, it wasn't me. I'm done.
Okay.
I wasn't the one speaking.
Okay, Brian. I think that's great. I appreciate that. That makes it easier. I would say whatever is voted on, I would say that this document should be part of the record, because we definitely want to have good documentation of the discussion and some type of comparison that we can defend whatever we decide on.
Thank you. Jason?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion.
Okay, hold just a sec. Any more discussion? Any more questions? Okay, I'll entertain a motion.
I move that pending the contribution from Galloway, that we move to the Schwab platform.
Joby, I'll second.
Okay. We'll take a roll on that. Angel?
Aye.
Joby?
Aye.
Dennis? Aye. Ooh, we've got Terry still here?
Aye.
Aye. Lisa?
Aye.
Rolf?
Aye.
And Jason? Aye.
Aye.
Passes 7-0. Thank everyone for that discussion. I mean, that was, it got a lot more clear today than it has in the past few meetings. And I'm glad that we got this we made this decision. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
I want to add, I just got word. So yeah, just confirming, just the individuals with self-directed brokerage will have the blackout period.
Excellent. That's great, because that sure alleviates lots of concerns. Okay. We are at item E2, the fee holiday invoices. So we have to, just a quick question, we have to vote on to pay those invoices?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. I will take
it's not. It's not. I'm sorry. We've already paid them. This is just informational.
Oh. Thank you.
Oh, that was easy enough.
I'm sorry, they were already approved.
Okay, sorry.
This is just for notice. Sorry about that. Don, you did tell me that yesterday. I'm sorry.
That's okay. We're all.
Yes, I know.
We are overloaded with information. Okay, item E3 is use of the administrative account funds.
I don't know if you want to discuss this now, or we just wanted to.
What?
If we wanted to keep. So that's just to keep that on the agenda about how we want to spend those funds, because the Jeff, what's the balance on that right now?
I got it.
You're still north of 300,000, but the discussion at the last meeting, and it was reflected in the minutes, was we need to figure out if you guys want to continue the fee holiday, which expires on June 30th this year.
Right. So currently, in the report, we have 355,800 in the administrative account. And it was approximately 130,000 last year for the fee holiday, or 160,000 on.
No, when we met last meeting about the third quarter and the fourth quarter had come out to the tune of, call it, slightly less than 85,000, right, roundabout.
Yeah.
The first quarter, I'm not sure, has come out yet. So that could be another 40,000 out of that 350. So let's say you're at 310-ish, right, roughly. I've got to double check that. So assuming you've got one more quarter of about 40,000, you know, let's say that puts you in a range of, call it 260 at the low to maybe 300 at the top. That's what you'll be at the end of the fee holiday, by the end of the year, or by the end of the second quarter. I'm sorry.
Yeah, because I'm looking at my notes from last time, and it looks like it's about $170,000 that it cost us, or will have cost us, for this year for the fee holiday.
Yes. So if you take the roughly 41,000-42,000 times four, yeah, you're looking at 165 to 170. Yeah.
170, which would take this would take it in today's dollars down to about 200, if. I don't, that's where I'm having a problem. Do we really want to run it down that far by providing another fee holiday? Joby.
My take on this is, while it was nice to give the fee holiday, I think it is important for us to have an administrative fund for things that just came up. You know, if there are plan enhancements we're trying to give to our full membership, or unexpected things that happen, as well as keeping the board and the staff, you know, trained and educated. I know those costs go through there. So, and I think what Jeff was saying is we've already committed to the next quarter. So our 300,000 is already going to be down to 260 or so. So I kind of land in not having another fee holiday at this point to make sure we have that fund in case we need it, because we're not getting any money put into that fund other than investment returns, correct? We don't have that funded
from any other source. Yeah, it's just not investment returns, but just interest on the Putnam, which is healthy now, right? It was close to, you know, 4% for the year.
Right.
But yeah, no other expenses are coming out of that account at the moment.
I guess what I'm saying is the city, you know, we're not funding that account any other way. We're not taking participants' money, or, you know, there's no there's no funding source for it to grow in the future.
That's correct.
That's correct. Yeah.
There's 260 there. It's going to be 260 plus market.
And I think, Mr. Chair, from my perspective, I understand Joby's point, and it is helpful to have that money there. I also want to keep in mind that from an IRS perspective, we want to be spending old money down in these kind of accounts. And as we just pointed out, this is all old money. It's not coming in each quarter. There's no fresh funding into this account. And so, although I don't necessarily advocate drawing it all down immediately, I do think it's important that we see some withdrawals every year. And when the money was set aside in the conversion to Empower, the intention was that it would be spent down. It is not intended to be an account that is maintained over the very long term.
So at that point, okay, so I'm on another board. I'm on an HOA board, and we do reserve studies where we want to ensure there's enough in the reserves for moving forward. So in this case, I'm almost looking at this as a reserve fund. However, we're not adding to it. And so how much should we have in this fund is really what I guess in a way I'd struggle. I mean, we had $500,000 a year ago. Well, I'm rounding up a bit.
Yeah. But solely from the compliance perspective, Mr. Chairman, there's no need to have this fund. And we shouldn't be looking at as that's a really good analogy, the reserve fund. But the IRS would not like it, that analogy. So I think that we want a plan to spend it down to, you know, maybe you keep no more than $50,000 in it.
Ooh, okay.
Well, Cassie, could agenda item number 5, I mean, when we talk about NAGDA or trainings, that's coming from this fund, correct?
Yeah. And so if there's something predictable, like NAGDA is a really good example, annual trainings, if we can set a budget and justify what that money's going to be used for over the next few years, that's helpful. But I think that we should spend down beyond where you are right now.
Okay.
And again, not immediate. It doesn't have to be immediately, but we should keep working on it.
We also... go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, to Joby's point, I mean, one training for the board, right, out to NAGDA probably draws down significantly.
Yeah, I would think, well, 3 of us went last year, 4 went the year before. You know, I'm going to throw out, I don't know if that's worth $15,000. I don't know, you know, because NAGDA is, what, $1,000 a pop? 4 nights in a hotel, playing per diem, and if 3 or 4 of us go. So, yeah, I like Cassie's idea. And maybe we can work on a budget, say, for the next 2 or 3 years with maybe $50,000 is our seller. And then, you know, how long does it take to run out? You know, say we got this down. If we give another fee holiday, we're going to be down about $250,000 maybe. And then we've got how many years worth of NAGDA training out of that? So maybe I think the budget idea is a good idea. And that way it is defensible if we ever got to the point that we're being questioned about the size of this fund.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be helpful.
Okay. So do we want to entertain another fee holiday, or maybe partial fee holiday, where maybe the fund picks up 50% of the employee's annual fees?
I think that's a good compromise, because it's showing that we are gradually drawing it down.
And I do like the partial, because at some point when the fund is exhausted, you do want employees to remember that there are fees associated with their accounts, right? So if you have a number of complete fee holidays, people quickly forget that they ever had to pay fees.
Right.
It's like if you give more presents throughout the year, other than one present, it might be good.
Well, how about a retreat? Yeah. This is a retreat. Okay. I'll entertain a motion if anyone's showing interest in another fee holiday or a partial fee holiday, or we just let it stand pat.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Jeff. When does our current fee holiday run out that we've approved?
End of the second quarter.
End of the second quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're in.
Yeah.
So starting fourth quarter, you'll start to see the fee come out. If you ended it now, in the fourth quarter, you would see a fee for the third quarter if you ended it in June.
Okay. Mr. So
Oh, I'm sorry. It ends June 30th is the end of it. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we collect. Yeah. So we got to do the average daily balance for the quarter. So for the second quarter, you wouldn't see a charge from the plan expense account. In the third quarter, you'd have to wait for the full third quarter to go through in order for us to take the third quarter fee in the fourth quarter. Or if you're doing a partial, the partial fee.
Right.
Mr. Chair, what I was going to say is, while I'd like to, and I don't want to give anyone more work, but kind of see what a budget, you know, if we had to see actually how much we have in there, and then have a budget written out of what a fee holiday would cost, as well as estimated trainings. But my only fear to that is, since we're, you know, when we meet again, do we need to have this decision made by then already? So I don't know that I'm ready to make a motion personally, but I wouldn't be opposed to it.
I don't think you have any time pressure, you know, to make a decision today.
I'm not concerned. If you come back at the next meeting, as long as we know by the next meeting, Joby, I think that gives me plenty of time to make the adjustments I need for the fees.
That'd be as far as timing goes.
Correct.
Collecting.
Yeah, fees. Just getting everything set up, however you guys are, whichever direction you decide to go.
Okay. So we can work on the budget. And then vote on it next meeting. We can vote on it now.
Is that direction to Lisa then, to kind of show us a budget, or would it be somebody else?
No, it would be me.
Okay. Is that something you're able to do?
Yes. And then as far as conferences and travel and things like that, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
Yeah. As well as if we think of 50%, fee holiday for our members, you know, if that's about 80,000, and then what are.
Yes.
Rick.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff, I just had a question for you. If the decision isn't made until, say, August, which puts us in the third quarter, if it were made in August and the fee holiday had ended June 30, but you're not able to calculate the third quarter fee until 4Q. Could they make the decision in August and then just stay on a fee holiday without interruption?
Right. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Is
great.
We're on fee holiday till you make a decision in August, and then I can change it from there, because we won't assess it until the fourth quarter. So if you guys decide to do half, then we would get another letter from you saying, hey, you know, we want the fee holiday to end 6:30 July 1st, start charging half. If that's the decision you make, then that gives us, you know, plenty of time to go into the record keeping system and change everything around before we charge it.
Great. I understood that you wouldn't calculate it until 4Q. I just wanted to make sure if they hadn't made a decision, that it wouldn't create an issue.
Yeah, no, we're okay. We're
Thanks
okay.
for confirming.
Yeah. So, we'll put off this decision till the next meeting. Is that what we, that way we can add the budget, more information in front of us, no interruption for the participants as far as, you know, turning the fee holiday off and then back on a quarter later, because I know that'd be a lot of work on Jeff's part. So. Okay. I want to skip item four for a moment, go to item five, because item five will be quick. I think the window for the discounted rate for the NAGDA conference, I'm not sure if it's closed yet, but I want to think it's about, you know, maybe 20-25% cheaper to do it early. So I'd encourage anyone that is interested to give some thought to it real quick and let Lisa and her staff know.
My question would be to Dawn. I know you talked to, I expressed interest when she reached out, but there was an issue with me logging into Workday or what I need to do with that logistically.
Okay, so I've been getting mixed information, and for that I apologize. Active employees have to do it themselves in Workday. Non-active participants, I believe, have to go through our office, but I can double check on that. Joby, are you still active?
I am not. I'm retired.
Okay, so then you're probably not going to be able to do it yourself. And I can have Alexis start working that out for us to get approval on your travel order.
Okay. And Jason, did you have a form you talked about with your group?
So those are active employees, but they are not City of Tucson employees. So on my team that I supervise, we have vendor employees, and they have to fill out the external committee member travel form. So I don't know, Don, if that's something the retirees on the board have to do or the inactive people have to do as well.
If you could share that, Jason, that would be great.
Yeah.
You could use that.
And then also, if I'm active, so I'll be doing it myself on Workday. If someone could send me some instructions or how to begin that, because I'd like to attend the conference, but Workday is not my friend.
Okay.
Most of the time.
I will ask Alexis, our administrative assistant, to reach out to you for that, because I don't know how to do it either, which is why I've been giving bad information. So yeah, I'll ask Alexis to reach out to you. You'll also need the accounting string from Lisa, because we cannot bill it to TSRS.
Thank you, Dawn.
Yeah, Lisa, if you could send me the account string.
Okay, so Ralph, you're going as well.
Yeah, I'm going for sure.
Okay.
And I've got to work through your office.
Yes, and Dennis is going. Okay. Is anybody
I've got to hop off. I'm in Dallas. I need to get to the airport. Is there anything really urgent that I need to be here for?
No, we're just going to talk about one more item that's been lingering since August, so you're good.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it.
All right, Ralph. Safe travels.
Okay, bye.
Thanks, Ralph.
If there's anyone else that is planning to go, let me know, and I can provide the account string or provide the information to your people who need to arrange your travel order. It's in September in Florida.
Lisa, let me take a look at the agenda and what they offer, and I'll let you know if I'm interested.
Okay, do you want me to send you the link?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Lisa, you may want to send to Terry also, since she already had to drop off.
Ah, I will. Okay.
Okay, we have one more item on here, and this, you know, with staff changes and such, the update on the Empower integration file. See, I remember taking notes back in August regarding the back and forth of the file, and we did have an IT representative at the meeting, and there was something with who was checking the work. It was doing a back and forth, and it seemed like, see if I have my note here, that we needed one more set of eyes. I've got down here, need to whittle down the data. There's too much PCI.
So if I can speak
to that. Oh, please.
Actually, I wasn't here at that time either. Yeah. But so there was too much still information in there. And the biggest thing was the Social Security number. Uh-huh. So since then, Anastasia has scrubbed all of those files. It was the payroll files that were coming through, and it still had the Social Security numbers on there. So she has since then scrubbed all the files of the current employees, and is still working. So everything's done as far as the integration file goes, mm-hmm. on a regular basis. And then the historical files she's also working on, but we're also going to be looking at our retention periods and how long we should be holding those records. So we may be destroying a lot of those things.
Get rid of those.
Yeah. Clients. So, but we're working on that right now. We're digitally scanning all of our records right now. Onto OnBase. Yeah, it's very exciting. We just finally got our cabinets for the OnBase system. So we'll be digitizing everything. So we're excited.
Great.
Yeah. So we'll be redacting probably some things, maybe, but it'll be in a very, very safe place where things, super secret Davis Monthan Air Force items are there and nobody else can get to it. So it's safe, just so everybody knows.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, I just go over old notes and I'm like, man, that's lingering. Yeah. You got to bring it back.
So that's for number three and number four. So,
got it.
But we're good with that. And we're still in the process of the historical.
Getting rid of historical. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Item F, future agenda items. So, in the best discussion. In the PEHP that Jason was talking about. What's that stand for?
Post employment health plan, I think.
Okay. And the
fee holidays.
Okay. Joby.
Is Joby's? Yeah.
If you would entertain, I just had two other ideas for future agenda items. One, I know I talked to you months ago, but I feel like we need a call to the audience as an agenda item. Because I think that's important. And then the other thing, Dennis, I know as we all found out our terms were extended and we weren't having elections, but looking at the bylaws, there is the rotation of the chairmanship. And so I don't know if we need to talk about that on an agenda item. I'm happy with your leadership as well. Oh, so,
that bad.
but maybe
you can put elections are coming up.
We talking elections for the board chair or elections for board members?
Don?
I have Rolf and Jason's terms expiring this coming January and Dennis's term expiring April 2027. So I have it in my calendar to start the election process for Rolf and Jason's chairs. It's coming up. I'm tripping over my own tongue. I will have started the process to solicit candidates before the next meeting.
So I'm looking at something from the clerk's office. So just make sure I heard you say Rolf and Jason. They are both appointed January 12th of 23. So January 11th of 27 is their expirations. Okay. And my expiration, according to this, is April 6th of next year. Okay.
Yes. And I went back and forth with the clerk's office until we were sure we had it right this time.
What if I disagree?
Then I can't help you.
No, it's okay. Because, I mean, I have a letter here from the clerk telling me when I expire, and it doesn't agree with this chart I got from the clerk in the last 3 months. So I'll...
Well, so when I first reached out to the clerk's office, the roster they had on file was incorrect.
Ah, okay.
And Mr. Chair, that's why I just wanted to talk, because I think that's when we had the whole change of the bylaws and the ordinance, and it went from 3-year terms to 4-year terms. Right. But also reading that, it showed that the chairmanship should be rotated on a 3-year term still. So that's why I wanted to make that an agenda item, just so we could talk about that, because we do have elections coming up and you know, people are terming out. So I think we just talk about that and see where we need to land.
Right.
Okay. And
good, Tess.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Just a note, when we made that change that Joby's referring to, the idea was we didn't want to lose the member at the same time that the chairman title moved, right? So we intentionally made that off cycle, that the chairman position could potentially move when the membership was not changing.
Right. So I don't know personally whether I am eligible to still be on the board after next June. We didn't have term limits until we did that change a few years ago. And so I'm tying this into the rotation, because if we vote on rotating it and then I'm gone anyway in less than a year, is it a moot point to do the rotation? I didn't get a crown, so it doesn't matter to me whether I'm the chair or not.
Statue for you.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we've got for future agenda items with Innovest, the post-employment health plan, fee holiday decision, adding a call to the audience to our agendas, and discuss chair rotation.